It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. We brought back one of our favorite panels from last year. Ed Bott is here from ZDNet, Christina Warren from Gizmodo, Devendra Hardawar from Engadget. We're going to talk about the right to repair. Apple says it's a terrible idea. I think it's a pretty good idea. We're going to take a look at the iPhone 8 and all of those fabulous rumors. Do you blame 4chan for the way the world is today? Some people think that's the problem. And Bill Gates says, I got a solution. Tax the robots.
It's all coming up next
on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for TWiT's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make TWiT even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 602, recorded Sunday, February 19th, 2017. Normcore phone. This Week in Tech is brought to you by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software used by over 10 million small business owners. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/twit. And by NatureBox, delicious snacks made from high-quality ingredients. Eat well and feel better. Visit naturebox.com/twit to save 50% on your first order. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter the promo code TWIT to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase. And by Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. Visit squarespace.com and enter the offer code TWIT for a free trial and 10% off. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech. Show where we cover the week's tech news. I'm sorry. Did I yell at you? I did. I'm sorry. I'm a little excited. I'm a little amped up because we got a great panel for you today. Joining me all the way on the left from Alamogordo, New Mexico, home of the E.T. game cartridge. It's Ed Bott. No, you're not from Alamogordo.
Santa Fe.
Close enough.
Santa Fe.
Close.
Turn left at Albuquerque. Hi, Leo.
Hey, great to see you.
Good to see you.
Ed, for many years, one of the premier editors in at Windows magazines, mostly, right? PC Magazine, PC Computing, right?
Yeah, PC Computing, and before that, PC World.
Loved PC Computing. Are you sad to see IDG? It looks like it's going to be bought by a Chinese company.
Well, it sounds like it's a really good company that's buying them. So it sounds like it's one of the best outcomes of, you know, there wasn't a great outcome in all of this, but it sounds like it's a pretty good one.
Yeah, I think so. Somebody told me it's really effectively was Chinese IDG.
Right.
So they understand exactly the culture. They want to preserve the culture, that kind of thing.
Yep.
Great to have you. Also here from Mashable, Film Girl, Christina Warren.
Host from Gizmodo.
God damn it.
It's fine.
Can we start the show over? No, I don't. I'm so sorry. You used to be at Mashable, and of course I knew you went to Gizmodo. That was months ago.
Yeah, six months.
I got to keep track of this stuff. Good to see you. And you're doing a lot of podcasts for Gizmodo, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Good. You want to plug them?
Well, I do a show on my own called Rocket on Relay FM. And so if people want to listen to me talking about tech, me and Brianna Wu and Simone de Rochefort.
Oh, that's right. That's a great show. Yeah. I love that show.
Thank you.
Yeah. I forgot about that. In fact, that's one of my go-to podcasts. Well, thank you for being here, Christina.
I love to be here. Thanks for having me. Hey.
And from Engadget, I think you're still at Engadget, Devendra Hardawar.
Yes.
Engadget.com. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And do you talk on Rocket? Do you talk about space?
Sometimes.
Because SpaceX had a successful launch this morning. I love Elon Musk's tweet. It was just a picture of the rocket going up. They delayed it yesterday. And so everybody's going, oh, no. And then they got it up, and this is going to be another ISS supply mission, I think. I don't know why I threw that in. Because a rocket, that got me in the mood. So what do you guys want to talk about?
I don't know. Whatever.
Nebraska. Let's talk about Nebraska. How often do we talk about Nebraska on this show? Nebraska is one of, I think, six states that are looking at laws to give you the right to repair. Nebraska, New York, Tennessee, Wyoming, Minnesota, Kansas, Illinois, and Massachusetts. The theory being you own a product like a John Deere tractor or an iPhone. You should have the right to fix it at any fix-it shop you want, including third-party fix-it shops. Apple does not like this, among others. In fact, they are now lobbying Nebraska lawmakers to kill the right to repair legislation, saying unauthorized repair will turn the state into a mecca for hackers. That would be a great license plate for Nebraska. Nebraska, hacker mecca. I don't think Nebraska will ever be a mecca for hackers, but let me ask you, Christina, some justification for Apple not to want to get these laws passed?
I think that their justification is that when you have unauthorized people performing repairs, they can often do repairs that might not be of the quality that Apple would want their products to be living up to. So if they, you know, repair the phone, you know, your screen, that's one thing. But if they're doing other sorts of logic board repairs, things like that, there could be problems with the phone that then Apple would be responsible for, that Apple would reputation would somehow be tied to.
It actually happened, right? Last year, there was an iOS update that fixed the error 53. And it bricked iPhones that had been repaired at third-party repair shops. And Apple's rationale was, well, yeah, because if you repaired it, we don't know that Touch ID, the fingerprint reader, is still going to work properly, and so we can't secure the phone. On the other hand, Kyle Weens, who's been a big advocate, he's at iFixit of Right to Repair. Of course, iFixit, which has been a sponsor on the show in the past, makes manuals and sells parts to repair stuff. Says that the rationale that an independent mechanic ought to be able to bypass things like error 53 that are designed to prevent repair. In other words, he says Apple did error 53 to ferret out and put out of business third-party repair companies. Apple's taking this seriously.
Mm-hmm. Are we surprised, right? This is the company that's all about sealed boxes and not tinkering, really. And we've seen their one computer that, you know, you could actually upgrade easily, the Mac Pro, has been ignored for so long. This makes a lot of sense for Apple. The bigger problem now is the Touch ID stuff, right? If you go get your screen or something fixed, they have to make sure everything is in line, and it's a lot tougher, I guess, if independent parties do that now.
Well, but caveat emptor. That's always been the case. If you want to have a cheap repair done and you want to save some money, you take the risk that it's not going to be of the quality that it would be if you went to an Apple store or an authorized repair shop. But to preemptively say that it's illegal for someone, or even if I own it myself, to scavenge parts, you know, to go to a place like Swappa and buy a phone that's no longer functional and take it apart and cannibalize it for parts and then use those parts myself, the point of a law like this would even prevent me from doing that, which is nuts.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, my main issue when error 53 happened and then Apple ended up issuing a software update that basically made error 53 no longer an issue. My issue with that wasn't so much, you know, even that they'd said, well, look, for the sanctity of Touch ID and for other stuff, we need to have repairs done a certain way. That's all well and good to say, well, if you want this to work, you need to go to an authorized repair center. But to your point, Ed, to say you can't do this at all and it should be illegal, that's insane. But the secondary problem is that when you're outside of the United States or major cities in other parts of the world, going to an authorized repair center is often difficult, if not impossible. So if you're, you know, one of the error 53 cases that the Guardian had written about when that issue came out was, you know, a journalist who was in a part of the world where there were not Apple stores and he needed to get his phone repaired.
Right.
And it had very important information on it. And, you know, then his phone was bricked. And so the issue for me isn't so much that they say we would prefer people to have their phones, you know, repaired by authorized places or Apple stores. It's that there are plenty of parts of the world where that's not a possibility. And so I think this sort of legislation has the potential to be dangerous if it were to gain acceptance, because Apple stores are in most cities in the United States, but they're not everywhere. And I don't want to be in a situation where I need to have my phone repaired and I can't get anything done because I'm 4 hours away from an Apple store.
This story comes from Jason Kobler writing at Motherboard. He says that he learned about it from Nebraska State Senator Lydia Brash, who was visited by an Apple state government affairs specialist. What the guy didn't know, apparently, is that not only is a Brash a farmer, so she, you know, is very aware of the John Deere issue, she also works remotely for a software company in Atlanta, has a background in computer science. She said, I think they were surprised to learn that I knew what they were talking about. She also said, a lot of times with Apple, there's almost always two interpretations. One, Apple's, and this is a perfect example, acting in the best interest of its customers to protect their security, to protect the integrity of the phone. The other, Apple's acting in the best interest of its profits. And in this case, it could be either way. This might lean you in one direction, because apparently Apple also said, just take the phone part out of the bill and we'll go away. They don't care about John Deere, who also wouldn't like people to, you know, John Deere's afraid people are going to pirate their software in their farm equipment. Brash said, it's tempting, but we need to repair consumer technology too. The story they're telling is we need to be afraid of technology. She says, you don't have to be afraid of technology. You have to be afraid of the people who are trying to prevent you from knowing the things you know. Are these companies in it for the greater good or the greater dollar? Good going, Senator Brash. Wow.
Seriously. Yeah.
When we talked to Kyle Weens, one of the things he said is only one state needs to pass this. There are eight considering it. He said the best one probably be Massachusetts. The reason is if any state passes it, all the manuals, all the parts have to start to be sold in that state. That means it's accessible to anybody in the U.S. So if one state passes it, it's as good as done.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can understand the concern, too, because Apple refurbished iPhones has become a bigger business for them.
Yes.
You know, they've made
especially
that,
in India.
Know,
that's how they're going to get into the Indian market.
For sure. And if you have all these third party repairs happening and you don't know the quality of the repair or something, you know, that phone is inherently less valuable.
Yeah, I understand both sides. Yeah. Really. Yeah.
Yeah. There is that. And honestly, the hacker issue, it maybe sound a little overblown, but you don't know what somebody's doing with your device when they take it to back room, you know, and start picking it apart. And a lot of the times you have to unlock your phone or give them certain access to it as well. They may not even need that, but they may tell somebody that they do. So, yeah, there's a certain value in making sure only Apple people are doing it, but we don't know if they're trustworthy either, right? So it's tough.
This particular part might be moot with the next iPhone, because Apple has patented a on-screen fingerprint reader as opposed to...
It's going to be the same deal, right? It's the secure element and tying that to the actual... Mm-hmm. Whatever is reading the fingerprint, right. I just had to get my screen replaced, and they had to do a whole thing to make sure that that was all connected with the new Touch ID.
Samsung does that too with Knox, right? If you attempt to modify or root a Samsung phone, they have a special counter, and as soon as it's been rooted, Knox and all that whole secure stuff just turns off.
Right.
Which I think is a better way to handle it. I think isn't that how Apple eventually handled Error 53?
Yes, that's what they wound up doing, which I think is acceptable. What's not acceptable is breaking someone's phone completely when they might not have had a choice in how the repair was done. But yeah, I mean, I think to Devinder's point, I mean, even though it might seem silly, you can conceive of if someone were to come up with some sort of exploit or make some sort of hardware modification to your phone or install something, you know, at that level, that's a kind of a scary prospect of then taking your phone to some unauthorized dealer. And now that's allowed because you have right to repair and telling the difference between the phones. For me, I think that would be the big consumer issue is how do you know that this refurbished phone has gone through the same steps as this refurbished phone? Right now, you know, if you buy one from Apple or if you buy one from some of the various, you know, places, you know, it's gone through different levels and have used official parts. I wouldn't want to buy a phone that had, you know, a battery made by someone that might not be up to spec or had, you know, a screen or even a home button that wasn't as good. Who knows? So I see both sides, but I think that saying that, that you don't have the right to repair your technology, no matter what your rationale is a dangerous thing to say. And obviously you're going to get pushback from a lot of people, including, you know, the senator of Nebraska, who, as you guys were pointing out, is very well informed on this issue.
Yeah. It seems kind of pointless to even fight the law too, right? Because the devices are getting more and more integrated. It's going to be tougher just to even like replace individual components. Yeah. And that's something we can't really stop and we can't really legislate against, I guess. But that's what's going to happen as the iPhone gets thinner and, you know, all the components just become one piece of the logic board or something.
Yeah, iFixit just gave the AirPods, I think it may not be the first time, but one of the first zero repairabilities because it's just, it's glue throughout the entire body.
Yep.
So you can't. Which
is fine.
Yeah. I mean, on a $150 pair of headphones, I guess that's okay.
I mean, honestly, I think that's completely fine. I mean, the replacement cost is, you know, $70 per AirPod, or, you know, it's about the same as buying, it's slightly less than buying a new pair. I'm completely fine with that. I mean, if to make things that small, would it be nice if you could do more self-repairs? I mean, sure, of course it would be nice, but gotta think about
miniaturization
of other stuff.
From my own experience, I had a MacBook, this is many years ago, and before the MagSafe adapter, you know, the power cord had gotten pulled out. And it bent and actually broke the connection of the power cord to the motherboard. Brought it to Apple. They say, well, the way we fix that is we replace the whole motherboard. That'll be $1,000. Brought it to when this place existed, the an independent Mac store in San Francisco, Mac Adam. And the guy said, yeah, we see this all the time. I just solder it back on. It's $15. And I was really glad that Mac Adam existed and the guy understood it and was able to fix it that quickly because I didn't want to buy a new logic board. But that's kind of – so that's why you should have the right to repair. And by the way, I think you do have the right to repair computers.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. And somebody on the chat was pointing out that this is really about making third-party repair manuals or making the repair manuals available to third parties.
And parts. Manuals and parts.
Yeah.
Apple does not – and by the way, tools, they have special purpose-built machines in the back to disassemble. For instance, you know, you can't disassemble an iPhone with just take a screwdriver to it. So they have all these special purpose. I understand. I've never been back there. But they have special tools back there, special machines even.
Again. Yeah. And it's not just about those third-party repair people, too. It's the competition, right? Apple is always about keeping its trade secret so close to the vest. I'm sure Samsung and LG and everybody has spent a lot of time disassembling these phones, but if they had the exact manuals too, you know, that'd be a little different.
And I apologize to everybody outside the United States for pronouncing solder. We're the only, so there's a couple of things we do really well here in the United States. We do Fahrenheit. We don't do the metric system. We do feet. We do in the imperial system. We don't do single payer healthcare, and we pronounce solder wrong. We're good at all three of those. All
right. I didn't know. Okay, this just shows my ignorance. I didn't know that it wasn't pronounced solder outside of the United States.
I didn't either until I started doing podcasts, and then I sure heard about it. To our couple from Perth, I'm saying it wrong, aren't I? Yeah, it's solder. It's also a router, not a router, right? But routing means something different in Australia.
Yes.
And don't ever wear a fanny pack in Great Britain. But that's another story entirely. You know, more than a third of our audience is outside the U.S. I really ought to start. I've already started saying Z instead of Z because actually that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
But solder, I can't get used to solder. It sounds like something's wrong. Solder. And I know if I do that all the Americans would say, why are you saying it wrong? Well, it was on my schedule, actually. We'll talk. Let's take a break. And then I want to talk about Sid Bikanavar, who is a JPL scientist, U.S. citizen, who had his phone taken away by the Customs and Border Patrol and data sucked. And what this raises, what issue this raises, and what you would recommend if you're going to travel outside the United States with electronics. I was talking about it on the radio show, and I'd like to hear what you guys think. Devendra Hardawar is here from Engadget, from Gizmodo. Film girl Christina. I can't call you film girl anymore, can I?
Sure, you can.
Can I?
Why not?
That's your Twitter handle. Film underscore girl.
Don't, Film_girl. I'll always be film girl. Why not?
It's her brand, okay?
Yeah. It's your brand, man. And Ed Bott, who is my contemporary practically from ZDNet.
ZDNet.
Leo. Do you ever say I can't say ZDNet. That sounds weird.
Yes, because ZDNet is a global organization. We have staff in Australia, the UK, Singapore, South Korea. And so Z is actually what the majority of ZDNet staffers say.
Wow.
So yeah, it comes up regularly.
That's cool. So I feel like I'm very, I'm very futuristic. I'm a global guy when I say Zed. And Solder. I'm never going to say Solder. This sounds wrong. Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy cloud accounting software. I discovered it first 12 years ago when I was a freelancer flying up to Vancouver, or actually it was Toronto, to do a call for help up there. And, you know, as many freelancers, at the end of every month, I had to sit down, and it was the worst thing. I hate it. If you think you hate paying bills, creating bills is just as bad. Invoicing people, you know, you got to sit down with Word or Excel. I had to bill them in Canadian dollars, so I had to change the currencies. I had to figure out what my expenses were so I could, you know, get them to pay for my travel. And it was just a pain in the butt. In fact, sometimes I just put it off. And of course, what I learned quickly is you don't invoice, you don't get paid. It was Amber MacArthur who told me about a brand new Toronto startup in 2004. It was called FreshBooks. Here we are 12 years later, and now 10 million people use FreshBooks. And it's not just to do invoices. Of course, that's where it starts, makes it really 30 seconds to a great invoice. And because the invoices have a button on them that says, pay me, you know, they support online payments, you're going to get paid an average of 11 days faster. You'll invoice faster, you get paid faster. You can also see which invoices have been sent, viewed, viewed. So you know more clients saying, I didn't get your invoice. Yes, you did. In fact, you looked at it yesterday. I see that right here. And paid, you'll also know what's overdue, what's outstanding, and you can even send a gentle reminder or a not-so-gentle reminder. They'll do that automatically if if they're late. But it's not about that. It's really about making it easy for your clients so you get paid faster. Everybody's happier. You can even set up recurring payments. So not only do you send out an invoice automatically, they pay you automatically. And believe it or not, a lot of clients like that. FreshBooks Now is really a total accounting solution. The FreshBooks dashboard, brand new front page, will tell you something so many freelancers don't know, whether you're making a profit, because they know your expenses, they know your accounts receivable. They can tell you. There's even time tracking built into the website and their FreshBooks app. So if you bill by hours, you can easily incorporate that into the invoice automatically, even divide it up by project and client, track your time to the minute. You can manage team timesheets. That's in there too. Track expenses. And when it's time for tax time soon, your accountant will love it, even if you are your own accountant. Because you can get all those, you know, accountant reports like sales tax summary, profits and loss statements and all of that. So the dashboard's great for you because you don't have to be, you know, a bookkeeper to understand it. You know exactly where you stand. And when you do need those specific reports for your bookkeeper, you've got those too. FreshBooks.com. Join the 10 million small business owners who use FreshBooks free. Do it right now for 30 days. FreshBooks.com/twit. And enter This Week in Tech, if you would. When they ask you, how did you hear about us? Because that way we'll get credit. FreshBooks.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. Did you see this story? In fact, I was just on Snopes. And Snopes says, well, because of the way security services work, we can't really verify this story. But I feel like it. I think it's true. Sid Bikanavar is a scientist at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Lab. He's U.S. born. He's a citizen. He's a NASA engineer traveling with a valid U.S. passport. He was in South America for car racing because he does that. When he tried to get back in early this month, he was detained by Homeland Security. He was stuck in a room where people were sleeping on cots, people stranded under the Muslim ban. They seized his phone and wouldn't give it to him until he gave him access for the PIN. Now, he said, this wasn't even my phone. It was a JPL-issued phone, and he had been instructed to keep it secure, But they also told him, the CPB told him, if you don't give us a phone, you're going to be sitting here for a while. We do have cots so you can rest. So he said, all right, I'll give you the phone and the pin. He said half an hour later, they came back with the phone after having copied his data. He says, now this is his Facebook post. And the reason he posted is, I'm removing my Facebook page. I'm removing my social media accounts until I know what they got and what they want. They have passwords. They have everything. And he gave his phone to the JPL to run forensics on it. They were apparently fairly upset about it. And he's working with legal counsel at JPL. So this is important. This has been the case for some time, but I think it's ramped up. When you enter the United States, whether you're a citizen or not, they can go through your bags, right? But the issue is, can they also go through your electronics? And lately, the opinion has been of the CPB and of federal officials that they can. They have the right to look at your computer, the right to look at your phone. I guess my advice and what my practice will be, is it enough to just turn off everything before we reenter the U.S.? Because I'm going to be traveling this year. Ed, what do you think? Ed, you're muted, I think.
Turn it off. Yeah.
There you go. Now you're back. Maybe that was us. Sometimes I mute.
I think so, because I don't recall muting. And at any rate, probably the border protection folks did that to me. If I had sensitive data on my computer, first of all, it would be encrypted, and I wouldn't give up the password for that. For any kind of social media apps, if I were in a situation where I felt I were at risk of being searched and having that information inspected at the border, I would delete the app and wipe out the cache on my phone before I re-entered. Because at that point, there's nothing they can do. And it's trivially easy once you get back into a place where you feel safe to reinstall the app or go to a different device, enter your password, do the 2FA, and there you are. But I would literally, for social media in particular, the simplest and best solution is to simply delete those apps and wipe the cache on your device.
I think social media is a good example because it often would lend itself to, and we've seen this before, to misinterpretation. People say jokey things that could be misinterpreted.
But the worst thing is that it is a social graph. And so as a result, they are finding your
not
friends.
Not just you.
And your friends.
Your
friends,
whole cell.
Your friends' friends' friends. Yeah. And yes. And so if you know somebody who knows somebody, you have a perfectly innocent friend who has a perfectly guilty friend, then your guilt by association. It's it's 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. And that's just, for some people, especially, for journalists, investigative reporters, scientists, anybody who, is in a vulnerable position right now, delete it.
When I went to China a few years ago, I did not, they ask occupation, and I was counseled not to say journalist, but to say teacher or educator, which I didn't feel was a lie. But now I'm going to do the same thing coming in the United States. And I feel like that's sad. This guy is a U.S. citizen, U.S. born, but I guess because he has a name with a lot of consonants.
It was a random search, Leo. Nothing.
No, it's a little darker than you and me. Well, maybe not you. Yeah. You're going to, I wouldn't, if I were
I feel,
you,
I've noticed random
Devendra,
searches here in
I would
New York
not
too.
Leave the town. I would stay in Brooklyn. Seriously, are you concerned? Do you travel internationally?
I travel internationally for work sometimes. So I have a Computex coming up. So that's, who knows what's going to happen between the U.S. and Taiwan, until
right.
then. But it's all kind of scary. And especially, as somebody, I'm not Muslim either, but I do feel like the effect of the Muslim ban would definitely make people treat me differently. And that's why this story kind of worries me. Your advice is really good, Ed, about deleting social apps, but that doesn't, your social content will still be out there. So it wouldn't be that hard for them to find who you are if you're posting publicly and, link you up to people. And the bigger problem is the data that's actually on your device there's not much you can do about it short of just completely deleting it and not keeping any data on your device that you don't want, you know, a government agency to see. Even if you encrypt it, like if you're, yeah, the NSA isn't going to get involved for most people. But yeah, we have ways of cracking that stuff now, too.
And
better
rights,
for it not to be there at all.
Your rights are different. So this, so in the past, we've always said, well, they maybe can force you to do a fingerprint unlock because, you know, courts have held over the years that a strand of hair for DNA or a fingerprint when they book you for an arrest isn't self-incriminating testimony. That's just information, but it isn't incriminating. And a password or anything that's in your mind, the police don't have the right to that because of the Fifth Amendment and the right against self-incrimination. So, but note that might be different coming over the border. The Border Patrol people, and the EFF has weighed in on this and say, you know, technically, ACLU said, if you're asked for your PIN or password, call us. But you want to come home.
Yeah.
You don't want to be spending the next few days in detainment at an airport. Airport jail cannot be good. And I can see why Bikanavar and almost anybody else would say, well, fine, just take the PIN. Rory Sellin-Jones, who writes for the BBC, writes about technology, broadcasts about technology, really great guy, asked the British Embassy what their advice would be if you're going into the United States. Actually, I'm sorry, the U.S. Embassy in London. All international travelers arriving to the U.S., by the way, apparently all American travelers as well, are subject to U.S. Customs and Border Protection inspection. This inspection may include electronic devices, computers, disks, drives, tapes, mobile phones, other communications devices, cameras, music, and other music. Why do they want my music? Music and other media players and any other electronic or digital devices. Keeping America safe and enforcing our nation's law in an increasingly digital world depends on our ability to lawfully examine all materials entering the United States. So assume that you will, that you're subject to this, and golly, this makes me sad that, that this happened. And the reason is, I think that to some people, searching your luggage and searching your digital devices is equivalent. Should it be? Isn't your digital device? This is really the debate. This goes back to San Bernardino and the PIN number and FBI wanting access to that phone. It feels to me like a phone has more of your personal stuff in it than your suitcase.
Mm-hmm. For sure. There should definitely be a differentiation. I'm still annoyed that they have the right to just search through suitcases. I've definitely lost cameras and other things that I've stupidly left in my carry-ons. They can just open them up and take whatever. Yeah.
You too?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I lost a camera that I was dumb enough to not take on as a carry-on. I thought, oh, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. No, it wasn't. It was taken.
But
it
could be just, somebody else could have stolen it.
Yeah, those are run-of-the-mill luggage thieves. There was a ring working in Newark Airport that finally got busted a year or two ago.
I would hope that law enforcement would be doing that.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I don't know. I
do remember reports of Homeland Security people, being tied to stuff like this, too. So,
or the TSA. And I certainly, I feel invaded if they want to go through my music, if they want to go through my my social accounts. And they've said this, we reserve the right to ask you for the passwords to your social media accounts.
Yeah. I mean, there have been some people who have suggested, and I don't know how tenable this is. This is the difficult thing. But I mean, some people have suggested that depending on what you do and what line of work you're in, taking a burner phone if you're leaving the country.
Right.
And depending on what type of work you do, that actually might not be a bad idea, because if the information is really sensitive, then you don't want to have any of your accounts on there. Because I know that for me, I'm obviously not involved in anything illegal. I'm not doing anything that would be going against what the, you know, border agents would want. But if they were to go through my social media profiles, go through other stuff, and you see something that you've made, as you were saying, Leo, somebody makes a joke, or someone on your timeline makes a joke that it could be interpreted the wrong way, or makes a political statement that's well within their rights to make that's interpreted the wrong way, you know, people could be detained or questions could be asked. And that's kind of a scary place to be. I'm very fortunate in that I have a lot of privilege having, you know, a last name and a skin color that might preclude me from some of these things, but that doesn't mean that it's not a real problem, and that I'm not concerned as a journalist at this state in time, you know, leaving when things are the way that they are.
I guess what really scares me about all of this, too, is like as soon as the travel ban was announced, we started hearing reports of, you know, people being detained at JFK, families, children being detained for hours with no food and no real way to get to their, you know, their relatives who are here. My worry is that we have all these, you know, just normal civil workers, people who are just doing their job. But at, you know, the stroke of Donald Trump's pen, they become willing participants in his like vision of fascism. And that's kind of how it begins, right? It's just people doing their job. Somebody doing their job, they take your phone. Somebody doing their job to detain you here.
Authoritarianism creeps up slowly on
It's terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. There's an uplifting topic.
But an important one.
No, I think so.
A really important one. And I think there's we are seeing a lot of interest in this from the ACLU, from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, from other organizations that are going to be pushing hard and speaking up very, very loudly about these issues, because it's just not what the United States of America is supposed to be about. And you know, so you got to push back on stuff like this. And to your point about it being inconvenient to be stuck in an airport, you know, I appreciate that. On the other hand, I appreciate the fact that there are people whose names are attached to landmark court decisions who did more than just inconvenience themselves.
Right.
They put themselves in harm's way and spent years fighting back so that they could establish these principles. So if somebody wants to do that to me, you know, great. Let it be, you know, bot versus the United States.
You're volunteering. Good for you. All right.
Yeah.
Let's
put it this way. Ain't nobody going to get my PIN or my passwords at the border, period, full stop.
And by the way, the ACLU says it is illegal for law enforcement officers to discriminate on any, you know, political beliefs, race, religion. But law enforcement at airports and border generally have the authority to search all bags and ask you questions about your citizenship and travel itinerary. But they have asserted, and, you know, it's unclear, but they've asserted they do not have the right to ask you for your PIN. And you can legally refuse them without risking court or jail time. On the other hand, they also may detain you longer. They may make it inconvenient or uncomfortable for you.
Well, I've got 3 international trips planned this year. So
me too. Me too. Two of them are safe, I think. Two of them, one's South America, one's France, but one's to Cuba. And I'm actually very nervous about coming back from Cuba.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I think maybe not bring any electronics to Cuba. It won't work. They don't have any internet anyway. So
right.
It's probably safe to do that.
Man, I think like the best outcome I've seen from all of this and kind of the hellfire we're living through right now is like the immune response system that's just kind of leapt up, you know, of U.S. democracy. Like the protests have happened. People are fighting back. So like I'm glad you said what you did, Ed, because I think if this stuff continues to happen, people will fight back and we will see like some resistance to all of this.
I don't know if you know who Dale Barron is. He is a comic artist. He does high quality precision comics at Dale Barron, and wrote a Medium post this morning, actually on Valentine's Day, that's been starting to be passed around, saying this is all our fault because of 4chan. And all of us have been around long enough to have watched the rise of 4chan. And it's his opinion that the what's happening in America right now is the logical conclusion of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I fully agree. I think that there is a group of people who are in it for the lulz. That's the 4chan people. I think there's more than that. There are a lot of reasons why this is going on. But it's a very interesting read, I think it's worth reading. It's on Medium. And he says, you know, he was an early 4chan user, and back before 4chan, a forum I remember called Something Awful. And of course, Pepe the Frog is a 4chan meme, and it's really interesting.
There's definitely like a philosophical through line that you can build from 4chan through like Gamergate and then to everything that's happened this year.
And so in some ways, I've often wondered this. You know, remember when we had the debates in which we all roundly disagreed with that, you know, all of these kids playing violent video games, that there was going to be some social consequence to a whole generation raised, you know, in front of a screen and so forth. And I wonder in some ways if that maybe there is a consequence. Maybe it just took a long time to come out.
Well, it wasn't the violent video games. It was the people who didn't really like have friends and found friends online. And
well, but that's where these guys came from, right? They kind of not everybody. Look, I played violent video games. We all probably did. But a certain percentage of people became very antisocial and a culture was created. I think that you can't disagree that there was a culture created and that's created. I know it's really politically incorrect to say this, but I kind of feel like that's what happened.
Well, I mean, there are separate things, right? There's the culture, there's, you know, gamer culture in general, and there are like subsections of that. And I don't know if I'd blame the games themselves. It could be anything. It could be any sort of game like this.
No, but I don't mean the game. No, please don't get that. I'm not blaming the game, but I'm blaming this kind of isolative culture. So, kids in the last 20 years have had the opportunity just to kind of not go outside, not even relate to people in real life, IRL, but instead relate to people on the internet, relate to people through forums and gaming, and become, I feel like it fostered a kind of lonerism that is, as it turns out, could be destructive, not only to the person, but to the rest of the world. I think trolling is a result of it. I think trolling is a direct outcome of this. And the for the lulls and a lot of this. And I want you to talk me out of it. Maybe I'm just an old man now, and it's just you kids. You see, I told you you should get out some fresh air, go get some fresh air. I told you. Except
it's not just the kids, yeah.
Well, me too.
Kids. And I don't think it's just the lack of fresh air. I think
part of it is they're not kids anymore. They're your guys' age, right?
Right. But I also think that part of it is that there became like social currency, and I mean real social currency in pop culture and other places where acting, you know, like a troll would lead to a certain amount of popularity and fame and attention. So, you know, like there are whole television networks and shows and real entertainment that are kind of built on these same sorts of jokes.
TV's just as much to blame.
And so, I mean, honestly, I would say that, I mean, if there's any blame at all to be said, I don't know. I think
blame's not the right
in certain ways.
Blame is a mistake, but just to see the consequence or the causality, perhaps.
I think though that there's been a pattern of rewarding certain types of behavior for a long time, financially, with attention, with fame, with.
I think of my adolescence. I was a loner. I played chess. You know, I did all the. Had I had the opportunity to sit in my basement playing games, and had we had the internet, I'm sure I would have been an antisocial. You know, I would have because you know I'm shy and introspective, and I would have just become that person. I didn't have that opportunity, thank God. I remember in high school.
Thermonuclear war.
That's my generation. In high school, you know, I had that same kind of snarky, and I knew others that had that same kind of screw it all, make fun of establishment mentality, that jokey mentality. But I couldn't weaponize it because it was just a few of us, and there was no way to talk to everybody else who was doing that. But now it's been, I think it got weaponized by the internet.
Yeah, it's totally the internet, though, not just games. But go ahead, Ed.
Right. Two things. Number one, this is not a new topic. There was a book written a couple years ago called Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, that addressed this exact topic. And it isn't just online services and chat rooms and communities and such. It's it's
society.
It's across the board.
Your generation was told you're the stranger danger generation. You can't go outside. You'll get kidnapped and mutilated. So all our kids had to stay inside.
Yeah.
I don't think staying inside had.
So there was a whole book that was written about that, and it's a very, very good book and worth reading. But I think the second thing that's maybe more important is that our social media networks have made the same mistake that the internet made in its early days. It was designed optimistically. So the internet was designed
assuming that people were good and benign, assuming there's no hackers.
So Twitter, for example, was nobody at Twitter, ever thought, Jack and Ev and those guys never thought that Nazis would take over. Right. Twitter. If you had told them that in 2007, when the first tweet said, "Just setting up my Twitter,"
I think they're more sophisticated. I think they knew that there were people that would do that, but and as did I, and they were the free speech wing of the free speech party, right? Absolute free speech. But I thought, and I bet they thought, that the sunlight would disinfect. That's a good thing.
But that's the mistake. The mistake has always been that bad speech, a small amount of bad speech, can always drown out good speech. That's why you don't read the comments, because the number of trolls.
We've learned that lesson, haven't we? Holy cow.
Yeah, but most of these systems were never designed in such a way that they could resist the cancer of hate speech and malicious and actors with malicious intent. Mm-hmm. And because these things were designed mostly to make money and to grow big quickly, without any concept of how to grow big safely and securely for the entire community, that's how you got viruses for PCs. That's how you got spam taking over entire email servers, and that's how you have Nazis taking over Twitter and fake news taking over Facebook.
The interesting thing is, I think a lot of these aren't really Nazis. I watched, and boy, it was painful, Milo Yiannopoulos on Bill Maher this week.
Ugh.
It was really painful. But he's the guy who was banned on Twitter because he used his real name, and he said, he's one of those people, I might have been that kind of person, I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm just having fun. I like that. He obviously likes the intention. I don't think probably he doesn't believe anything he's saying, but he massed an army of people on Twitter. And the reason he was banned, not because of the things he said, but because the things he said incited whole groups of people to go after other people. He was very adept at manipulating a mob on Twitter, in effect. And I watched him, and I think that a lot of these people are like him. I don't know if they're not ideologically Nazis. They're probably not even ideologically racist. They're in it for the lulls.
It doesn't matter.
I agree. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
But this PewDiePie story is related, right? Mm-hmm. Because PewDiePie, of course, we've talked about this a little bit, but he was banned. In fact, I got a number of tweets last week after talking about it saying, you misunderstood this entirely. PewDiePie was banned from – he had a deal with Maker Studios, part of Disney. And, well, actually, let me tell you what happened. And then we'll take a break because Aussie Geek Girl in the chat room has to go to the bathroom. But as soon as I go through this. So what PewDiePie says he did is there's a service called Fiverr, two R's. You give somebody $5, they'll do stuff. And he thought, well, it'd be fun if he just tried it and paid $5 to get somebody to say death to Jews. And a couple of guys in India took the money. PewDiePie then, and this is all on the video, and you can't see it, it's been taken down, professed shock and dismay that Fiverr would, A, allow him to do that, and B, that somebody would take the $5 and do it. Oh, my God, I'm shocked. And this is kind of what PewDiePie does, is this kind of, this is how mm-hmm. this is how you get 53 million subscribers on YouTube. And, but he crossed a line, obviously, and this kind of anti-Semitism will not stand. Disney dropped him. even YouTube didn't, they didn't kill his channels, notice.
No.
But they said, well, you can't be part of the special kids who get special advertising deals.
You just continue generating ad revenue over there.
Yeah.
That's all.
But I think this is another example of this kind of culture where, oh, look what I did. And the question is it okay? And I think so. The emails and tweets I got were, well, you don't understand, PewDiePie. This is, he's mocking. He's showing. He's showing, holding up a mirror to culture and mocking the culture. And
that's
and
a saying, sense of humor.
It's funny,
right?
And it's, I remember when I was 16, doing kind of not that bad, but doing snarky, funny, kind of sarcastic, anti-establishment stuff. But it's been weaponized now, right? PewDiePie did it for an audience of 53 million people on YouTube.
Yep.
And you did friends. You did it.
I did it for
friends,
my friends, and we laughed, and they kind of knew the context, and that was it. And I sure didn't do it for a teacher or a parent.
Well, and I mean, I think people have made the comparison, said, why is what PewDiePie did not okay, and what, you know, South Park and It's Always Funny in Philadelphia and other programs do, why is that okay?
Good question.
I mean, and I think that's a fair question. Ben Kutcher at Polycon wrote, I thought that his response was pretty good to that. He was like, well, they're funny. And PewDiePie's biggest sin was
his
sin, stuff
wasn't, but is that a crime, even, not being funny?
Well, I mean, I think that if you're going to actually try to shed a light on a, you know, a social mirror or a construct of these sorts of things, you have to do it with a certain amount of nuance, and you have to do it with a certain deftness that he didn't have, obviously. Having said that, even if he had been very, very funny and very skilled in the way he did it, I still think that there would have been backlash. And I mean, that's fair. Both things are fair to me. I think that he has the right to make videos that say whatever he wants to say, and whether his jokes are funny or not, if his audience enjoys them, even if they don't enjoy them, he has the right to make those videos. By the same token, you know, advertisers and companies like the Walt Disney Company have the right to say, we don't want to be associated with this sort of content. Both things to me are completely fair. He can continue making his videos. Advertisers can say, we will or we won't allow advertise on with you.
One of the things Dale Barron says in this article, is that 4chan defined itself by being insensitive to suffering in a way that only people who have never really suffered can.
Yes.
That is to say, young people, mostly young men, protected by a cloak of anonymity. That's kind of it, isn't it?
It's a death of empathy as a culture. You know, I was that snarky teenager too, and I think every teenager is. Yeah, we all.
Because you don't know any better.
We rebel against what came before. That's how culture moves forward. You know, that's just the way it works. But I feel like we've spanned so much in this conversation, Leo. So I just want to quickly say, like, the bigger problem for me isn't that, you know, it started with all these kids just being at home alone and, you know, not allowed to go outside. But it is the power of communication and what the internet enabled. You could look at talk radio. You could look at so many things, reality TV, you know, what people watch and do extends far beyond the internet, but the internet became the tool for rallying together. So my early time on the internet, I spent a lot of time chatting with people about video games and anime and stuff like that. And now you go and look at kind of the subcultures that are forming around some things. It's gross. It's disgusting because of kind of what the internet has become and how widespread it's become. So, it's a problem of communication. And my big worry is, this loss of empathy.
Well, and this is a conversation that was probably being held in some quarters in 1938. The rise of mass media enabled Joseph Goebbels and Adolf Hitler to seduce and sway a German populace. It was the first use of mass media for very much the same thing.
And film.
Oftentimes new technologies offer new opportunities. And I think there's never been a more powerful technology than the internet. But Ed, you said this is the inevitable consequence. Can we get past this?
Well, I didn't say it's the inevitable consequence. I said it's something that needs to be taken into account during the design process for any kind of system like this. I don't know. Certainly Twitter. There's a million things that Twitter could be doing, and they're doing one or two, maybe. I don't think these people are literally Nazis. But you know what? If somebody, and I know people, and mostly they're women, whose Twitter feeds have been polluted.
Oh, yeah.
With pictures of
It's horrible.
Of you know, Holocaust scenes and them being pushed into ovens.
Well, you work with Brianna Wu, Christina. I mean,
I do.
You know this intimately.
Absolutely.
Nonstop. Nonstop. And so there comes a point.
She was chased out of her home.
You asked the question, what's the test? Well, the Supreme Court actually came up with the test. It in Miller versus California, the test was serious. Let's see, if it's utterly without socially redeeming value, then it's pornography. If it lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value, those are, you know, I mean, I could look at PewDiePie. Is there any redeeming social value in the work that he did? Is there any serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value there? Perhaps let someone make the case for that.
I feel like,
but you know what? Some random Twitter account with a Pepe the Frog beam attached to it that is spewing pictures of Auschwitz to people with Jewish last names. I think Twitter ought to be canceling those accounts and making sure that the people behind those accounts don't recreate them. You know, it doesn't seem
they say
like
they're
it
doing
that,
although
difficult.
I haven't seen any evidence of that. But
yeah,
that is a harder problem, right? Canceling killing accounts is easy, but making sure that, you know, people can create fake emails pretty easily, like that's the
and
sort
use,
of thing
and
that's
use
getting
VPNs
tougher.
And hide their traces. Yeah. So, I mean, if somebody decides to be anonymous on Twitter, it's fairly trivial to do that.
Maybe phone verification could be a thing, like, because
they'd have to institute some sort of verification, exactly right. Yeah. But there's still burner phones, right? I mean,
that at least requires a protocol, but
at that point you have eliminated the problem that we have right now is that there are literally programs that are troll generators. They create bots. Yes. With one T, and those automated accounts can just go out and spew hatred far and wide. Well, guess what? If you create some sort of validation process for them, you have kneecapped the industry that creates those automated hate generating systems. But Twitter is in trouble economically. Their revenue has declined for what now, 14 straight quarters or something like that. And for them to do that would be for them to admit that the vast majority of accounts that have been created are not real. And you'd get back to the point where you could see, you know,
crash.
What Twitter really is.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'd economically collapse.
Yeah.
And so for economic reasons, for the same reason that PewDiePie is still allowed to have his stuff up there and have advertising revenue created to it, you know, generated from it. You know, it's the same thing. As long as people are making money from it, they're going to have a hard time doing the right thing.
Basically, all Google said to PewDiePie is, well, just for that, we're going to take more of your revenue. That's the punishment. Wow. All right. You know, and I also understand that maybe I don't understand fully what is, you know, I come from white privilege, right? So I'm not going to suffer. And of course, it's the ultimate in white privilege to say, oh, this is just joking. It's, you know, kids being kids. No harm's meant. It's not a Muslim ban because I don't have to worry about it. So I am challenged, and I bet you many of us are challenged about how to think about this, what it really means, where we're headed, what is the upshot of this. I really thought the internet was going to be a voice for everybody, the ultimate democratization. It was going to liberate the world. Mm-hmm. And it's very sad if this is the final result. I can't accept that. There's got to be a way forward.
I wouldn't say this is the final result, but this is a result, right? This is it's a result of many things too. It's a response to, having Barack Obama as president for 8 years too. Like, that's led to a lot of a lot of resentment and a lot of pushback in other ways in politics, and that kind of led to Trump as well.
There's a lot more going on. I agree.
Yeah, we're stepping through, you know, these stages as a society. Yeah, the internet now is the greatest communication device we've ever had. What I've always loved about Twitter is that it's sort of like that. To me, it's like the Matrix timeline of what's going on in the world, right? It's just like looking down, seeing code, and like seeing what's happening in the world. And that's, there's good and bad to that, and we have to figure out how to move beyond that. But I also think we kind of have to, yeah, get a little more enlightened as a culture to do that.
You know, what's really interesting to me is that despite the fact that none of this could be foreseen 260 years ago, hell, we didn't foresee it 10 years ago, that nevertheless, the fundamental truths of the Constitution seem to work. I feel like the Constitution has some deep kind of profound value, ethical truths in it. And if we could exercise them, we might make it, at least the polity might make it, this country might make it. That doesn't have anything to do with our culture or how people will be.
Yeah.
But
and where it didn't work, we spent a lot of time, you know, amending it, yeah, and fixing things. Yeah, so that's, yeah, that's, I actually just rewatched Steven Spielberg's Lincoln last night.
I saw your tweet.
I had to feel a little good about, you know, this land of America. And that movie, I love that movie. It's a really strange thing because it's like a play. But I love that movie when I first saw it. Watching it now, though, seeing people fight for, you know, the 13th Amendment, it's kind of heartbreaking.
It's like been seeing, like this, yeah, though. It's been so through much of American history. That was, you know what? I've been reading a lot of history books for the same reason, because I'm trying to understand, is this a unique moment in history, or is this just a very, and it is, a very common cycle in the American experiment. We've been going through this for 260 years.
Have you read the biography of Andrew Jackson?
Wow.
John Meacham's biography of Andrew Jackson.
No, I have
is
to
worth
read
reading.
That. I've been doing a lot of reading of Andrew Jackson because he's considered a populist president, much in the mold of Trump. And Trump has a big portrait of Jackson on the wall next to his desk in the Oval Office.
An interesting character and probably misunderstood, but a better reason to read the biography is not so much to understand him, but to understand the times and how that was 25 years before or 35 years before the Civil War started.
Right.
But it, all of the pieces were in place for it to have started, and it was inevitable. Unfortunately, it's a great
that.
Book though, worth reading.
We'll read that. All right, let's take a break. Let's have some snacks. We can get our blood sugar up, and we'll continue on. you know, you guys were great the last time we were together. Now I remember. Devendra Hardawar from Engadget, from Gizmodo, it's Christina Warren, and Ed Bott. Great to have all three of you from ZDNet. I mentioned snacks because our sponsor is Nature Box. And I always love the time that I can open up my new Nature Box. Nature Box is the solution to the junk food Jones. You know, that time, you know, 2 p.m. when you go in the back and you say, is there a candy bar with my name on it? You don't want to do that. And that's why we give the employees Nature Box. They're created with high-quality ingredients, free from artificial colors, flavors, or sweeteners. They're delicious, and you always get a great variety in your Nature Box. And if you, at any time you say, that snack's not for me, they will replace it free. How about nutty power clusters, nut squares with walnuts, almonds, and cashews? How could that? Would you like some? You're nodding. I can see. Go ahead. Take some. This is for me. Naked trail mix. Nuts, raisins, seeds, and dried fruit. And I love this because you look at the ingredients. It's peanuts, raisins, almonds, roasted pumpkin seeds, dried apples, cashews, peanut oils, and salt. That's all. I'm serious. Come and get some. But this is all for you guys. Crunchy barbecue twists, peanut butter graham jam. Well, that's new. They always have new. They have like a lab that's making peanut butter cookie. Peanut butter coated grahams with dried fruit and peanuts. Yeah, you want some. I know you do. Go ahead. You can. Zesty nacho curls. Anyway, here's your Nature Box. There are over 100 snacks to choose from. Pass them around. Choose the snacks you want. They deliver right to your door. There are new snacks every month inspired by customer feedback. We have a happy audience now. Eat well, live better. If you ever try a snack you don't like, we'll replace it free. So if there's something you don't like, give it to me and I'll get a new one. Right now, you'll save even more. NatureBox is offering all of you 50% off your first order. I would give you some right now if I could, but I can't. So go to naturebox.com/twit. Look at that. Asiago and cheddar cheese crisps. The dried fruit, that dried mango, the dried pineapple rings, they have the best dried fruit I've ever had. And there's nothing in it. It's just the fruit. Love it. Naturebox.com/twit. 50% off your first order. Share the snacks. Share the snack wealth. Naturebox.com/twit. Did everybody get some? All right. There's more. If you... The audience will be quiet now for a moment.
Just the faint sound of chewing.
Nom, 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 nom. All right. Let me think. Where should we go here? When you talk about all this serious stuff and deep stuff, and you guys are so smart, I almost feel bad saying, and what about those iPhone 8 rumors?
It's a little hard to write about phone rumors, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do we want to talk about those?
But what happens, though, is, you know, these things become, like you say, this is more important than everything else. And you get people, you know, somebody on Twitter just called us all douchebags because he says, you know, he says, well, those TSA regulations are from 2014. So don't blame Trump.
I didn't blame Trump. You know, I didn't even mention Trump.
No, I think, but that's how sensitive people are. But you know what? If somebody had asked for the passwords to my social media accounts at a border entry in 2014 or 2012 or 2010, I would have said no then too. But you know what? It's only coming up now.
Right. Right.
It's
been coming, so though.
Let's talk about the iPad Pro.
We did talk about that, by the way, in 2014, and it has been coming. There was some concern about that.
We did.
So we've seen this coming. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with a douchebag. It's a lovely device for cleaning yourself, and I'm clean as a whistle. So there you go.
It's a form of lavage.
It's lavage. Douche means shower in French. So what is this tweet of yours? I don't understand. You better explain to me. Compare the screenshot with the user profile.
Well, okay, you have to look at that entire
thread here.
Go back up.
Go back up.
To the top.
All right.
The top.
This, by the way, one of the things I'm always confused about Twitter, which direction is up?
Yes.
Right? Which is the most recent one?
So Apple has launched a new ad campaign for the iPad Pro.
Yeah.
And they're quoting tweets from PC users.
Now, you think Republicans and Democrats are a vicious fight, but you get PC users tweeting about iPads, you got a problem.
So you look at this guy, and so they quote his tweet.
It's Jeremy. He says an iPad Pro is not even close to being a computer.
Okay, so now you can scroll down.
Because here's Jeremy.
And that's actually Jeremy on the right.
Wait a minute. So Jeremy on the right.
The guy who really
NASCAR
really
kid
posted that tweet.
Yeah, he's a white guy, a redhead,
a white guy
actually.
from the University of Alabama in Huntsville, probably.
Yeah.
They replaced him with this guy
with a nice African American.
So now scroll down to the next one.
Is this a pattern?
Yes, they did four ads.
Oh, they went the other way. Like they went the other way.
Well, what they did was to replace these people who are all kind of, normal Americans, but also edgy. And they replaced them with people who look like they work in an Apple store.
They probably do, right? Who did the original tweet is Hispanic, a YouTuber, singer, fitness, and student beauty enthusiast. But apparently this is somebody who spends a lot of time in her bedroom concerned about spiders. I don't know.
I thought the whole thing was very funny. If you're going to use
gapify
real people,
these users.
Yeah, gapified. They've been gapified. That's exactly right.
The larger issue is that they're trying to capture the same lightning in a bottle that they got back in Switch. 2007.
Justin Long. John Hodgman.
With the Mac versus PC ad campaign. But at least in that one, you know, they were creating characters, you know, and they were writing scripts and all the
I don't understand why does this is an Apple ad. So why is Apple running tweets that are knocking the iPad? I don't
because I think the concept of the ad is that people will say, oh, I can't do this stuff. And then they will actually use.
Oh, I see. The iPad. So these people have.
Each one is some sort of complaint from a PC user, and then the ad. And then they let them use an iPad. And then they say, look at how great, you know, look at how the iPad Pro will solve your problem.
You know, Microsoft's done ads like this too, right? I mean, this is.
And if you scroll a little further down in that thread, I'll say if Microsoft had done this kind of ad campaign. Oh Lord, they would have been crucified.
Oh, she is scared of viruses. Is what she was scared of. Let's see what this guy Jeremy, the NASCAR enthusiast, he says. My iPad Pro isn't even close to being a computer. And then they give him a keyboard and a pencil, and they do email.
Look at all the stock footage.
He's happy. It's not a computer. It's better. Okay. Hey, you know, what are you going to do? Ads are ads, right?
Well, right. But I thought this doesn't reach the level
of Gmail man.
No. or the Internet Explorer 8 in private browsing ads, which were, you know, frightening. You know, those were truly awful. But I thought there were two things about this ad campaign that struck me as weird. First of all, Apple's been going back and forth about, you know, the iPad Pro is a PC. It's not a PC. It is. Right. Now they're saying it's better than a PC. It's a PC
plus.
Well, I mean, they definitely wanted to go against a Chromebook. That's in a lower end PC.
Oh, is that where they're aiming? Yeah. You know, actually Microsoft's doing the same thing. They have a new version of, what is it? The cloud version of Windows?
That's the rumored version. Yeah. I mean, I think both of those.
But the iPad. But they're doing this with the iPad Pro. For the activities that they're talking about here, you cannot get an iPad Pro configured the way that they have them here for under $1,000. So if they're trying to go up against the Chromebooks and cheap PCs. Yeah. This is that's the part here to me that's a really weird disconnect, because they're selling a $1,000 plus device. You can tart an iPad Pro up to about $1,600, I think. Yeah. And that's not a Chromebook.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing. And the other thing that I just thought was weird was to do this thing. I mean, if you're gonna do PC users complaining about PCs, either use the real people or you know, get Justin Long and John Hodgman
might
back
as well. Yeah. Christina, I'm sorry, I cut you off. What were you going to say? I cut Christina off.
Yeah.
Oh no, I was just saying that they're clearly aiming this at the Chromebook and at lower end Windows machines. Now, whether that's a fair price comparison or not is another situation, but that's clearly how they're targeting the iPad Pro. And I think that's one of the ways they're trying to kind of change the idea of what an iPad was, you know, from kind of being, you know, a tablet, which at this point has become, for, you know, everything that's not an iPad, a very inexpensive kind of secondary computing device, to being able to say, actually, you can do real work on these things. And I have an iPad Pro and I love it. And I think it's a very good tablet. And I think that depending on what apps you use, ironically, I think that the Microsoft apps are some of the best apps that really show off the iPad Pro. But yeah, I mean, it's difficult for them. They're in a weird spot because the MacBook starts at what, like $1,400, the MacBook Pro rather. You know, you've got the MacBook, which starts at $1,300, so or $1,200. So you're in a spot where this kind of is their less expensive option. Even though it is a lot pricier.
Zephyr in the chat room's got it. She says, marketers have gotten so clever, I'm completely confused. That's really the final upshot of all of this? I don't know. And I talk to people all the time on the radio show. I don't know what to get. Seriously.
That's sort of the problem, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Apple in particular has lost their marketing mojo, right?
Really? You think so?
All the ads right now. I think so. They're not. Even from
like
when the first
ad.
iPhone ad, yeah, that one's nice. But compare like to the earlier iPhone ads and the iPod ads, like I remember seeing the first commercials for the iPhone 7 and it was so weird and dark and fetishistic. Like it was like a David Fincher commercial for like, you know, a very dark movie. Like, look at this all black iPhone. Isn't this amazing? There was no fun about it. There wasn't anything about how this would make your life better. It was more like, look at this awesome monolith of a thing. And I don't know if they can get their messaging back. Maybe they need better ad people in general.
I just got the Samsung Chromebook Plus and the Pros coming out in a couple of months. These are the first, and Dell's doing it now, and Asus mid-range, not super cheap, but not pixel expensive Chromebooks.
Right.
And I'm starting to wonder, really, if a tablet is the right choice for a lot of people. That for a student, I don't think a tablet of any kind is the right choice when you can compare it to a Chromebook, a $450 Chromebook with touch, with a pen, convertible, with the Android store and Chrome OS. That's a pretty compelling choice for $450.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I use that. And that's a good it's a good Chromebook. And I think you're right. I think it is very compelling. And that's a difficult position then to be in, to say, okay, well, what is your app story or what is your experience story on either an iPad Pro or on a Windows machine that makes this better than what you can do here?
Yeah. I mean, I think the iPad is a great words with friends machine. But we have a lot of the journalists who come on, including Harry McCracken, use iPad Pros as their main machine. And I just feel
I'm recently seeing more people do it. Yeah, I don't think I would be able to do it, but I do think that with the keyboards, the new iPad Pros, I have the 9.7. The other one is, you know, the big 13 inch is too big. Yeah. It's a very powerful machine, and I think Word on the iPad is fantastic. And you can do a lot of stuff with that. And the split screen stuff does work very well. And some of the creative apps from people that I've talked to who are more creative than I am, or at least have better drawing skills than I do, really like things with the Apple Pencil and can do a lot of work on it. But I don't know if I don't think I'd be more productive on an iPad than I would be on a computer, whether it was Windows or a Mac. But I do think that you can be a lot more productive than you might initially expect, which might just be the point of these ads, which in fairness to Apple, I think that this is strictly a YouTube campaign. I don't think that these are actually going to be airing on television. That doesn't necessarily, you know, make them any better, but I think it puts them in a slightly different qualitative thing in the, you know, Apple marketing, hierarchy of YouTube ads are a little bit less than television ads.
Do you think that Apple might have painted itself into a corner? Because they don't, I mean, their cycles are, you know, a year. They don't have a huge range of products. They've kind of really doubled down on certain kind of pathways. Mm-hmm. And on the PC side and on the Chromebook side, you're seeing much more vibrant ecosystems, much faster cycles. Android phones, you know, I look at something like this Surface Studio, this Microsoft, Touch hybrid thing. It's probably a limited market. But the fact is, there's much more choice out there. And I feel like in the long run, Apple's almost a monoculture, and it's going to hurt it in the long run because they can't throw things against the wall in the way that the Chromebook industry, the Android industry, the Windows industry can do. Does that make sense? What do you think, David? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's Apple's in a really strange place, right? Because they've been so innovative for so long with the iPhone, the iPad, and that's all worked out really well for them. And it feels like things have been really kind of static for the past couple of years. You know, the biggest thing they've announced was the Apple Watch, and they didn't even quite know what to do with that.
But it was inevitable, right? the success of the iPhone, the worst thing that can happen to a company is a massive success like the iPhone.
Yeah, it's the innovator's dilemma. Right. I think there's a name for that. Yep. But yeah, in cases like this, like Apple has in the past just kind of killed its darlings. You know, when the iPhone came out, we knew that was going to kill the iPod when the iPhone came out. and that ended up happening eventually, but Apple could do that as a company. But now they've gotten so, like, they've been living off of iPhone profits for so long, and that's been so good for them. I don't know what they could do that would be hugely transformative moving forward. And even basic things too, like the Apple TV, I think they finally started doing some stuff with it, but there's still no 4K version yet. There's still a lot of that hasn't fully lived up to its potential either. So they're in a weird spot right now.
And yet,
you just look at the last batch of MacBooks, they weren't that interesting.
And
either.
Yet their stock is at a record high.
Uh-huh.
The company's the most valuable company in the world. Their profits are through the roof. They sold 75 million iPhones last quarter. It's not like a failing company, but I just...
No. Yeah. But that's the problem, though. When you have all those successes, it makes it harder to take chances and to be more nimble, because you have so much more at stake.
This article from Bloomberg, Alex Webb and Alex Sherman writing, Apple struggles to make big deals, hampering strategy shifts.
I have a big problem with that article.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Good. So let's talk, because I had never heard this particular point of view. Tell me what your problem. What does the article say, and what are your problems with it?
The article is basically saying that they don't make enough big deals, and that they should be working with more M&A advisors and big banks to acquire big companies. And then they need to buy Netflix. Basically, that's what the article is saying. They need to buy Netflix because that's the only way they're going to be innovative. And the fact that they have historically, Beats was their biggest acquisition at $3 billion. You know, most of their acquisitions have been under $500 million. You know, they make mostly smaller acquisitions, that's a problem, and that's holding them back. I think that thesis in and on its face is untrue. I mean, you can make arguments that maybe they should be, as a company, making bigger strategic bets in other ways. But I don't think, for instance, that Apple spending $19 billion on WhatsApp the way that Facebook did would have in any way opened them up to a newer market or would have helped them in any conceivable way. I don't think that Apple, you know, making some of the acquisitions that some other companies do would change anything. Buying Netflix, A, that's not possible. If that was possible, it would have been years ago, but it's not a possibility. They would have to spend. Do I think they should spend their entire cash reserves to buy Netflix because they want to get into video? No. I mean, I think that makes very little sense. If you wanted to talk about, you know, buying the Walt Disney Company or buying, you know, Time Warner, which was apparently something that they discussed at one point, that might make more sense if they were trying to do that. But I think that the argument that the article is making is that the reason that they're not as innovative is because they're not making enough big enough acquisitions. And I don't think that's the case at all. If you could show me one acquisition that they missed out on that would have ended up paying huge dividends for them, that and if you could also show me conceivable proof that the reason they didn't get that acquisition was because they weren't willing to pay, that might be one thing. But as it stands, I mean, I think John Gruber did a pretty decent analysis of this too. You know, this was a lot of M&A people complaining that Apple doesn't do enough M&A. Yeah.
Well, but it was also, I mean, I think the revelation of it was that Apple is arrogant when it comes to market. They don't work with investment bankers. They dictate terms.
Sure.
They say take it or leave it. This isn't how you make deals. They have the money.
You're not wrong. But again, I mean, I would feel a lot better about that supposition if you could show me what's a big deal they lost out on.
What should they buy?
They should have bought. Because again, you look at the big acquisitions that Google and Facebook have made, and even some of the ones that the Microsoft has made. You know, Microsoft made a great acquisition of LinkedIn, you know, $25 billion or whatever it was. Or was it more than that? That made sense for Microsoft strategically. That would not make sense for Apple strategically. Yeah. So, you know, I look at that and I see as investment bankers upset that they're not let into enough deal flow,
yes.
And also right. Investors who are mad that Apple didn't buy Netflix. And it's like,
it sounds like sour grapes. Yeah.
Netflix isn't going to sell anyway. Like, right. Netflix is not going to sell. Like, I don't.
And in a way, the article tanks itself because after they show the graph of the big deal famines and how little money Apple spent. They say, right, instead of closing big deals, Cook has so far focused on growing Apple's service businesses, including Apple Music, the App Store, and iCloud. That's beginning to work.
Yeah, it is.
With the company recently forecasting annual revenue of $50 billion, they made $23 billion last quarter alone on services. So, this has been a terrible strategy.
Reading this article.
Basically, Apple is in the position now that Microsoft was in around 2006. They were you know, the cloud stuff was taking off, but nobody could really see it yet.
They were
but
a dominant monopoly in desktop software and operating systems, and they were minting money.
And they were using that to build another business, another cloud business, and diversify themselves. And so what you have right now with Microsoft is a company that has, you know, 10 or 12 different businesses that are each worth, you know, several billion dollars in revenue per quarter. You know, seven or eight that are worth at least $1 billion per quarter, and several of them that are worth much more than that. And as a result, you know, they've managed to be successful even when many people had written them off. Apple can coast on the kind of growth scenarios that you just described, things like services, for another 10 years, continuing to grow in a way that would be healthy for any other company, except for the fact that they're the largest corporation in the world. Mm-hmm. And they need to find, they need to diversify, because at some point, the iPhone is going to become the next iPod. With the innovator's dilemma there, they need to find another hit in there. But when you get, you know, Bloomberg and other publications, they are writing for investors. They are writing for people who are buying stocks. They're not writing for the people who buy the products, and they're not writing for the people who make the products. They do have the point about making deals is just, well, that's traditionally the way that smaller companies get larger. But Apple, mm-hmm. I mean, they're so huge. Really, there's almost no companies that you can think of that they could buy that would allow them to actually grow.
Although maybe some good options would be the companies that they've consistently failed to make deals with, right? Like, so the Time Warner thing kind of made sense. We've been hearing them having a lot of trouble trying to form deals with cable networks for some sort of like over-the-top Apple TV, content distribution there. So that sort of thing could be good. As we're pointing out, like, Apple is going to be in a good place for a while. That's what Tim Cook is good at. But it's also like, yeah, Microsoft back a decade ago, Ballmer was really good at kind of, you know, making money at a certain point, but not as much with the big ideas and the big innovations. And then we've seen Microsoft make some big shifts with Satya Nadella. I'm wondering, like, yeah, what does Apple need to kind of get that mojo back?
It's interesting. I'm looking at you mentioned this, the stock price isn't everything by any means, but I'm looking at Microsoft's, I've screwed up the graph somehow. I'm looking at Microsoft's stock price. And the period that you mentioned, they've been flat for years. You know, Microsoft's big stock growth was in the late 90s. Okay. They'd been flat for years. And then this is the big growth here, then flat, 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 flat. Then along comes Satya Nadella and a new attention to the cloud, and Microsoft's been really on a tear over the last three years. Yeah. So it is very telling. I remember for years we said, you know, well, Microsoft stock, yawn. Well, you know, it's, why is it going nowhere? So this would be something to said for that strategy. What would you do, though, if you're Apple? I mean, this is challenging. You can only sell, there's only so many people in the world you can sell iPhones to.
And there's no way to dig up Steve Jobs.
And
get him to come back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Invest in AI and replicate Steve Jobs through AI. Yeah, that's what you do.
All right, let's take a break. Go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
Christina. No.
I was just going to say, when we have seen them try to go into other things, you know, the car project has apparently completely changed forces. So that's a difficult thing because... Right. You know, sometimes things seem to work and sometimes they don't. It's hard.
Apple's secrecy hurt it? Because, I mean, I am sure there are many projects going on in Apple R&D. There's a lot of R&D going on. But no one knows. So all we see is kind of the big blank building and the success with the iPhone. They may have big thing.
I think it hurts it, but I think that the secrecy helps it as much as it hurts it. I think if anything, it evens out because... people anticipate things and wait in a way that you might not if you outlined exactly what you were working on that Google does.
It's a great marketing tool, that's for sure. In fact, they're hurt a little bit by all these supply chain leaks now because last couple iPhone announcements, we knew what we were going to get ahead of time. Took all the fun out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Our show today brought to you by having fun with this great panel of people from Ed Bott at ZDNet to Christina Warren from Gizmodo and Gadgets, Devendra Hardawar. You guys are great. If I, you know, I like to have panels in studio with us, but somehow Skype doesn't seem to slow any of you down. You do great. I appreciate it. Our show today brought to you by a fantastic product called The Tracker. It's a Bluetooth tracker. I think a lot of times I want to kind of do a little education on the tracker. People look at it and they assume, oh, that's a GPS device. It's not, because you couldn't. That would be crazy talk. You'd have to charge it up every night. It wouldn't be a very useful tracker. And it couldn't be the size of a quarter, and it couldn't weigh, you know, just a few grams. What this is it Bluetooth device that pairs to your GPS in your smartphone and helps you locate anything you lose. According to Newsweek, the average American spends 55 minutes a day looking for stuff they own but can't find. 55 minutes a day for looking for lost keys and wallets and luggage and musical instruments and bicycles and pets. 55 minutes a day. And all you got to do is put a tracker on them. You can pair up to 10 trackers to your smartphone. It's Bluetooth LE, so the battery lasts a good long time. And tracker is one of the few Bluetooth tracking devices that has a replaceable battery. So there's, you know, it really bothers me that some of these other devices, when the battery dies, you're expected to throw it out and buy another one. Not the tracker. Easy to pop in a new battery and get another year. You can customize two-way separation alerts. So if you leave your key, let's say I put them on my keys. If I leave the keys behind, my phone goes, hey, you left the keys behind. If I leave my phone behind, the tracker beeps at me. There's even a button on the tracker you can press. It'll make your phone scream, even if it's silenced. So, you know, that is really useful. It's about the only thing I ever use the Apple Watch for, frankly. You don't need an Apple Watch. You can get a $30 tracker to do it for you. Now, the neatest thing about the tracker, they're selling like hotcakes. I talked to them a little while ago. I think they were doing 100,000 new trackers a week. 3.5 million devices shipped. And that's a good thing for you as a tracker owner because of the Tracker Crowd GPS network, the largest in the world. In fact, if you show that map and scroll out, you'll see there's trackers all over the world. So here's why this is a good thing for you. When you get out of 100-foot range, obviously Bluetooth isn't going to track. So you'll have on your phone the last place it saw the phone. But what if somebody picks up your keys and mails them to Malaysia? Why? I don't know, because they're bad people. Well, now you think your keys were left in Las Vegas, but they're actually in Malaysia. How would you know that? Well, there's tons of tracker owners in Malaysia. And if any one of them walks by your keys with the tracker in it, their phone goes, oh, I see Leo's keys, and sends you a message. So this is really awesome. It's like you have 3.5 million people helping you find your things. Go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Actually, the hardest thing to find will be the site, because they spell it funny. T-H-E-T-R-A-C-K-R. No E at the end there. No E-R. Just T-R-A-C-K-R. Thetracker.com. Use the promo code TWIT, and here's what we're going to do for you. Get all the trackers you need. You can get them engraved. They're anodized aluminum, so they can engrave them. They even have a nice UV LED printing thing. See, this tracker has a TWIT logo on it. It really looks good. So you can, you could have your picture on it. You have whatever you want. So get the whole order together, and then as you're checking out, use the promo code TWIT, and they'll throw in an extra tracker just for free, just for fun. Isn't that nice? Thetracker.com. Promo code TWIT. Get your free tracker, Bravo, today. We're going to have more with our great panel in a moment. But before we do that, I think we should take a look at a lovely little movie that Victor has made for us. Victor Bognot, one of our editors. Every week, he watches every show and puts together a little cut down of some of the best moments.
Previously on TWIT.
We've heard about Apple's foray into original content for the Apple TV, and now we have a trailer for Planet of the Apps. It's basically Shark Tank, but for app developers.
I think I already do this show. It's called iOS Today. We wear hats.
Oh, well, that's better than what we saw there.
Yeah.
This Week in Google.
Let's all encrypt. What do you say? Keybase.io. These are secure chats. You also have a secure file system that are totally encrypted using public key crypto.
The new screensavers.
We're going to give you a little demo of the June Smart Oven. This is an oven that connects the internet, your smartphone. It controls all of the cooking process, which burners are on, whether it's broiling or baking, what temperature it is at. So let me check the cookies. Of course, I could just look to my left and look in the oven, but why do that when you've got a video of the cookies cooking?
Twit.
In live, real time.
Tech just like you like it.
Is there like an age minimum for old media status? I'm kind of curious about that.
You're young old. You're one of those young people who's old. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think so.
You ever had the early bird special at Denny's?
I don't know what that is.
Oh, you ought to go. It's fantastic.
We're all going. We're all going. Jason Howell, what's happening next week on Twit?
Hey, thanks, Leo. Here's a look at a few things that we're going to be keeping an eye on in the week ahead. And to be completely honest, it's a pretty quiet week. Mobile World Congress begins the week after, so they're, you know, kind of dried up like a vacuum, everything else, but I'll do my best here. On Monday, February 20th, Tesla will reportedly begin test production of the highly anticipated Model 3 ahead of the full-scale production that takes place later this year. The target release date is still this July, but according to CEO Elon Musk, that could change if suppliers can't meet Tesla's requirements in time. On Wednesday, February 22nd, Google opens up the application process for this year's Google I.O. Developers Conference that takes place in Mountain View in May. Would-be attendees must visit the site to register for the lottery, and if chosen, pay $900 for the ticket. And on Friday, February 24th, those of you in the UK who've been waiting with bated breath for Google to make the really blue Google Pixel phone available to you, wait no longer. Pre-orders are open now, and it's a limited edition color, so get on it fast. And look, I told you it's a slow news week, so scheduled events, there aren't a whole lot of them right there. That's what we have. Megan Maroney and I will cover all of this and a whole lot more all week on Tech News Today, each and every weekday at 4 p.m. Pacific. That's a look at the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
Thank you, Jason. Also host of All About Android. That's why he's excited about it. He has a really blue Pixel. What do you carry, Devinder, these days? Are you iPhone or Android?
I still have an iPhone 6S. I'm just going to, I think I'm going to refuse, to go without the headphone jack for now. But I also have a Pixel XL I'm playing around with.
He's a refusenik. Mm-hmm. And I know what you have, Christina. That's obvious.
Why is that obvious?
Because I can tell. You're just a iPhone 7S person all the way.
And it's
really
Seven
got, Plus. I mean,
yeah, the 7 Plus. It's the rose gold,
rose
of course.
Gold.
It's pink.
Of course. See, I knew. Ed, are you still rocking that Windows phone?
I haven't used a Windows phone in over 2 years.
That's mean. I'm sorry.
I have a brand new, relatively new iPhone 7 Plus, and I also have a Nexus 6P here that I've been using for about the last 4 months or so. But I'm in the iPhone ecosystem for a while now because, you know, that's where all the interesting stuff is happening. That, you know, it's
really
a theme that I keep coming back to. But, you know, 10 or 12 years ago, people may have said that Windows machines were boring, but that's where all the developers were. And that's that's where you had to get. Well, now, if you want to get stuff done, iOS is where the developers are.
Yeah, I guess that's sort of true. I hate to say it because I like Android a lot. and I carry both just because, you know, that's my job. If I had to choose, though, I think I'd probably go with the Pixel. Reason I bring that up is it's going to be that crazy season again. Mobile World Congress is coming up. We're going to see new Samsung phones next month. The Galaxy S8, not at Mobile World Congress, but after.
No.
HTC is doing something interesting. Apparently, they're eschewing the low end, and they're going to go with high end hardware. They're going to kind of follow the Apple route. Apple's always avoided the inexpensive phones. They've announced this a month or so ago, and I'm hoping we're going to get it soon. I ordered one, you know, because I want to review it. This is the HTC Ultra. It's all about you, the letter you. And, you know, there's some personalization features and so forth. HTC's always had interesting audio stuff. They also have a second screen with icons on it. And they've also abandoned the headphone jack. They're going to have a Type-C jack. But they're one of the things that they're justifying that with is this kind of weird, and I don't know how it's going to work, audio thing where you put in the headphones and it creates a personal audio profile. I don't know if you have to do, as you have to do with Samsung, a hearing test. Samsung does that. Or if it just somehow knows. It sounds like it just somehow knows. Because your inner ear is as unique as your fingerprint, HTC U Sonic audio platform analyzes your inner ear and automatically adapts the sound profile to optimize your listening experience.
Sure. Okay.
Sure. Whatever. Yeah. Sure.
That's a thing.
Sure. It's not a thing, but maybe it is. Maybe I just didn't know. I bet you have to do a hearing test.
Mm-hmm.
Why did I bring this up? Oh, I know why. They're so grateful that I pre-ordered one. They sent me a backpack with all these toys in it. And a personalized thank you note.
Aw.
Nice.
Yeah, with little Android toys and a thermos nice. Bottle and a t-shirt. I bet you they're sending this to everybody who orders one of these things because they're expensive.
How much was it?
iPhone price, whatever that is, $749 probably. I don't
okay.
know. The Ultra is $749.
When I ordered an Nexus 6P, a year ago.
Yeah, they sent you a Lego charging stand,
the whole Lego thing there.
That was a Christmas card or something. I can't remember, but I would like the one company that will never do this is Apple. They're not sending out 75.8 million backpacks. I can tell you that right now. But I think these other companies are doing anything they can to get your attention at this point.
Please buy my thing. Please.
But if you buy a pink MacBook, you get the pink rose gold stickers. So, I mean, there's that something.
Wait a minute. You do?
Yeah. The color, you get gold with the gold, pink with the pink, black with the Mac Pro.
I got my black sticker.
I have a whole collection of Apple stickers.
Yeah. I don't have the Mac Pro anymore. I gave it to Nathan Olivares Childs, but I kept the sticker. I thought best part of it.
I reviewed it, and I kept the stickers. I sent it back.
Keep
and
the
was
stickers,
like,
yeah.
Your stickers
every
are,
time we send fun. Christina something, the stickers don't come back. Do they complain about that?
No, they don't.
Okay.
Drop the stickers, take the cannoli. Is that how we should have
Anyway, mid-March, they say they'll be shipping the HTC U Ultra. It's pretty. And, you know, it's the real problem HTC has is what everybody has. It's a glass slab. What are you going to do?
Yeah. All the phones are getting boring now. But the Android phones in particular, right? They're all going to have really, really thin bezels, really big screens.
Yep.
And that's pretty much it.
Yep.
And Google is trying to establish that there's a market for high-end Android devices, but I'm not sure. You know, Android's proposition has always been, we're half the price or a third of the price of an iPhone, and the Chinese companies are doing a really good job of continuing.
Absolutely,
in that.
ZTE, Huawei,
All of them doing that. So the idea, when I look at, and in fact, I looked when I was saying, okay, what am I going to, I'm going to buy a phone here. Is it going to be an iPhone 7 Plus or a Pixel XP? XL. Pixel XL.
Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. And they're the same price. Well, guess what? I'm going to get the one that's going to maintain its resale value and is going to have, all the developers writing apps for it. And it's also a really nice phone. But, at the same time, I just don't understand whether there really is a market for high-end Android devices.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think there is. I just think that it's going to
Big
be
one?
Specialized and right. probably... I think that's Samsung's like market.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that until the Note 7... exploded, that was it. And I think that the S8 is going to have a challenge because of the branding problem that Samsung has. But I think that's, honestly, I think that's where Samsung has fit in.
Over that. They even decided to keep the Note brand for the Note next year.
I mean, we'll see. Note. We'll see if they keep the Note brand or not.
They
I don't
said
know
they're
they
going, didn't they?
I mean, they said, but we'll see. I don't know. They have
I
a lot
think
of...
they've transcended it. I think people... don't you think people are waiting for the S8 and look forward to the S8?
Oh, yeah, but not another Note, right?
Not enough.
Exactly.
Not
precisely. Enough. I think the S8's fine. I think the Note would be a problem.
Don't you think
because
the Note will be the safest phone ever made? Seriously.
No.
Well, it ought to be. If you were Samsung, don't you think they would go bend over backwards to make sure it doesn't explode?
The S8 definitely will be. Yeah.
I think it'll be the safest phone ever made.
I mean, I think that's going to be the interesting thing. How do they market it and how much the marketing is around safeness?
Well, you
and
saw how much at their press conference, they said, we're going to have an 8-step program. We're going to x-ray the, we're going to do all this stuff nobody's ever done before and make sure they're safe.
Right. But my broader point, though, is, I mean, I think Samsung has achieved a brand, and HTC had this a little bit, but they never quite got there where, you know, people buy a Samsung, they're buying it for Samsung. They're not buying it for Android. You know,
I agree. That's the brand, isn't it? It's not Android.
And so I think that is your high end Android phone.
I see a lot of people. Maybe it's just the people I hang around, the nerds I hang around with. But I see a lot of people saying, I love the Pixel.
Yeah. The Pixel's a great phone.
It's about the most boring phone ever. I mean, there was an article. I can't remember who did the article. Google got an interview with Google and the engineers who designed the Pixel and all the efforts they put into choosing and naming the colors and the chamfered edges. And it was so clearly just an attempt to say, no, really, it's not a boring phone. But look at it. You can't.
It's pretty boring. I love it though.
It's my favorite Android phone right now.
I think I love it because it's fully embraced how boring it is.
Exactly.
What can we do in the back? Let's get
it's normcore. It's great. It's normcore, definitely.
Normcore phone is exactly
normcore phone.
It is.
It's normcore Android, but hey, it's great. And people who have it seem to love it. I haven't spent enough time with it to give it like a full assessment, but what little time I have, it's a great phone. It's a great
camera.
Phone.
They found a great camera. I mean, this competes with the iPhone.
I think it's the same sensor as the iPhone.
But everybody uses those Sony sensors. Like, it's the secret sauce after the
exactly,
sensor.
Exactly. That's
right?
The thing, right? And they've done really, I mean, Samsung does good software too, but yeah, Google really nailed it, which is very impressive. So good on them.
By the way, the chat room agrees. Christina, you win the title for the title, the crown. Normcore Android, that will be the title of the show, or maybe Normcore phone. We're going to battle that out. The Normcore phone. I like it. But one thing HTC is doing, which is interesting, and I feel like they're on the precipice of bankruptcy. Maybe I'm wrong, but this is not going to help. They're offering free 1 year, what they call protection for a cracked screen or water damage, free replacement.
Didn't they do that before?
Great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been around.
It's very consumer friendly. Yeah. Oh, they did this last time?
Yeah.
But I mean, hey, if you're spending $750 on a phone, that's great because it's kind of like getting your Apple Care built in. I like that. That's a good move.
What they say. Yeah. All right.
But it does look like the same thing is happening in the high end Android device category that has happened in the PC category. If you look, there's been this weeding out of it used to be that you could go down, you could count the top 10 PC makers, and you know, you'd have Toshiba down there and Fujitsu, and you know, their numbers wouldn't be that big, but they were profitable and everything. But those guys are kind of disappearing.
Yeah,
you know, Toshiba in particular is in big trouble, and Fujitsu's gotten out of the business, and Sony's gotten out of the business, and you're getting this consolidation where the ones at the top are still doing okay. The Samsung.
Same thing happened in televisions, didn't it?
Yeah. The same thing happened in so, you know, it's sort of something that happens in technology. But as the market is growing and expanding at a huge rate, you've got room for these, you know, rising tide lifts all boats, etc. But once it starts to flatten, then, you know, if you're in position number 6, you know, boy, you're in trouble. And I don't know where HTC is in all this, but with with Huawei and LG in there underneath Samsung, it's not encouraging.
Not good. I wouldn't be surprised by this time next year if somebody buys HTC because things are kind of rough for them. Yeah, their best stuff right now is their partnership with Valve. The Vive and everything.
Well, somebody said that. But do you think they make money on the Vive? I mean, how many Vives do you sell?
So, but I think they have mind share. I think that it's at least. I agree with Devendra. That's their best thing. I think right now is that partnership.
And that's far more innovative than anything Apple's doing right now, honestly. Like, Apple has no foray into VR yet. I'm sure we'll see something soon. They need an OLED screen on the phone for that. So that'll probably all be tied into the iPhone 8 or whatever they call it. But you know what? Valve is sitting there as a company with a ton of money and with a partnership with a company like this. They should just buy HTC.
That's what I was thinking.
Make some Valve phones. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and they might not even need to buy all of HTC, just buy, you know, the VR division and maybe part of the phone divisions that they're interested in, because
and
HTC,
they're already separate.
It was a lot of things.
So HTC doesn't even make it in the top 10 cell phone manufacturers. Top five are Samsung, Apple, Huawei, one of the Chinese companies, Oppo, another Chinese company, BBK Communication Equipment, which I'm thinking probably is India, but I don't know. Those five together sell more phones than the rest total. So
yeah, a lot of low-end devices in there too. For emerging
BBK
markets.
Is Chinese, I guess. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The Chinese companies are going to, just as they have with television, they're about to take over from Samsung, LG. Sony's long gone. The Japanese companies are long gone. It's going to be TCL and what's the other one? Hisense. Yeah.
The big TV makers. Yeah. Yep. Vizio still.
Vizio's Chinese now. Good news.
They just got sold. Yep. Has that closed officially? But yeah, no, Vizio is Chinese.
Yeah, maybe not yet, but yeah. Okay, this is a good question. How many of you read Mark Zuckerberg's 6,000-word communique on the future of Facebook?
Didn't do my homework.
I tried.
I read it.
Did you? Okay, Christina, you win. Congratulations.
Yeah.
What the hell does he mean?
I didn't know there was going to be a test.
AI will save us. Bots will save us. I don't know.
Building global community. He published this on Thursday. You know, Facebook's mission statement was like one sentence. Yeah. To connect the world and make it better through connection or something like that. Somehow this turned into a 6,000-word manifesto. I tried. Well, I really did.
He really wants to be president, guys. He really, really wants to be president.
He said he's not running.
Oh, yeah.
You're running, right?
They're not even hiding it. All these campaign trips, like these short trips everywhere, meeting the people. It's pretty clear.
You know who else wants to be president?
Who's that?
Mark Cuban. I think remember there was that Trump tweet out of nowhere slamming Mark Cuban? Out of nowhere? It's because Mark's running. As is President Trump, strangely enough. Then Cuban at the All-Star game came out in a jersey with the number 46 on it. Coincidence?
Well, he's a very good provocateur.
I guess so. I would vote for Mark Zuckerberg. I know that's nuts. But
I don't think that I would. But
really?
I don't know. I'd have to hear his position on the issues.
Who's he running against? Oh, he's a nice guy.
He's a very nice guy. I just, I don't know if he has the personality type.
He's one of us. Christina, he's one of us.
That's why it's bad. That's why it's terrible.
I wouldn't run for president. I wouldn't want any of you guys to vote
for me.
You
don't want me to run for president. No. I'm the worst.
Does he have a private email server?
He has a private
you know what? Turns out that's okay now. Didn't you get the memo? Yeah. That's okay now.
Yeah. It's only okay when you're doing it. That's how it goes. Yeah. But for Zuckerberg, like, I wouldn't be surprised in 8 years or even somewhere down the line that he'd be thinking of this, because, you know, everything we've read about his personality, reading his biographies and everything, it seems like he's changed quite a bit from, you know, the early days, from his college days. He's built Facebook to be a really interesting and fascinating company. I don't think it's going to save the world like he thinks it will, but he's a very interesting person, you know, to consider in that sort of role, because what he's doing at Facebook is that jump for Instagram, like, you know, paying that sort of money, I think ended up being a very smart move for him. So there are certain things I think he's doing that could be interesting and smart for a president.
Well, he took a company public that was already making a lot of money and made it incredibly profitable. Like, when you compare, you know, Facebook to Twitter or to Snapchat or to any others, he's run a very good business. I don't disagree. And I also agree with you, Devendra. I had the same immediate gut reaction. I was like, oh, well, this is definitely part of the stump speech. This is definitely the manifesto that says laying out, you know, my candidacy. But, you know,
used to be the way you would do that, by the way, is you'd write a book, right? Every president up to Obama, you write a book.
Obama wrote books, yeah, exactly.
And now, but Zuckerberg is a child of our century, and
he's writing Medium posts on the phone Medium that Facebook has, Facebook pages or whatever.
This is instant news, isn't it? You're right.
Yeah.
The only reason I know it's not Facebook is because I have all these ads for recommended games and.
Right. But other than that, it looks just like media.
Yeah. If you just cut the right, like just make it bigger and just cut the right part off, it looks just like Medium. There you go. This is why I have a Surface Studio. I can cut off the ads on the right.
Cut off the ads.
So these are the five questions that he wants us to answer. How do we help people build supportive communities? By the way, note the use of the word community. How do we help people build a safe community? How do we help people build an informed community? How do we help people build a civically engaged community? And how do we help people build an inclusive community? I mean, these are all nice anodyne sentiments. There's nothing wrong with any of this. I don't know if it inspires. I'm not going to run to the barricades over it, but...
Yeah. It fits into sort of what we were talking about, though, like the need to kind of change how we are looking at online community and communication in a way. I'm not a fan of how much Facebook has basically taken over the internet and instant articles and everything. I love the open internet, but yes. I don't know. Maybe at some point we'll need some sort of ways to kind of make it a more welcoming platform for people in general.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings on this, you know, and I always told people who use Medium or Facebook to publish that really you ought to own your own and have your own website. That's really old fashioned.
Yes.
But I mean, Facebook doesn't replace
the
internet. There's still an open internet. It's just one of the things you can do on the open internet.
Well, if you look at what they tried to do in India, they really wanted to replace the internet.
Well, okay. And maybe this is a little devil's advocacy. And I remember talking to Om Malik, who said this is, you know, rejected it out of hand, saying it's just a form of imperialism. And India knows better after the Raj and the, you know, English colonization of India that not to go for these freebies. You know, but from Mark's point of view, he's looking at a giant population that has no internet, can't afford an internet. And he's trying to find a way to subsidize
a
part of the internet. Obviously, you can't do the whole thing, but he gives you Wikipedia and health, women's health centers and things like that, in addition to Facebook.
And that's a wonderful goal. And I don't think anybody is discounting that. But what you can also say is
the Indian government did. They said no.
Well, exactly. But I'm just saying, the broader picture is like, oh, that's a nice thing to do.
Yeah.
But that's not coming without strings. That's coming with strings where you're saying we will be deciding what people see and we will be the tunnel in which you see it. And that is a very different thing than saying, well, we are going to give free data access to anyone to access it any way they want. No, they're saying we want you to access it through our lens. And that's, you know, that's understandable. That's saying we want to get people online, but not because we want them to be online. I mean, maybe that's part of it. We want them to be online through Facebook. And so, yes, I understand why that was rejected, because it does come across as very imperialistic, where you're saying, well, people are going to be gaining access to things they might not have had access to, but instead you are creating a whole new class of customer who are only going to know the internet as you and not know as anything else.
Does Google's Loon project, by the way, they've discovered they can do it with 10 balloons now instead of many more. Does Google's Loon project have the same strings, or is it just internet?
It's not quite as, it doesn't have quite as many strings, pun intended. As I think what Facebook was trying to do with India, but it has some of the same concerns. I mean, I think there Google, except for like the big market that they're notably absent in, you know, has an advantage in that they basically touch every piece of the internet, whether you are through the Chrome browser or Android or not, you're touching Google's ad servers and Google products.
You don't have to go to Google to participate in Google. You're doing it all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you know, even beyond like Facebook's free internet offer, the way Facebook is built today, you know, everything about instant articles, the way they've been pushing Facebook video on media companies, they've definitely kind of insinuated themselves into the process of media. And a lot of people just read news by going through their Facebook feed, right? And instead of even going to a publication website, they'll end up on something on Facebook. That's what's worrying me.
Yeah. No, I understand. Absolutely. The last four paragraphs of Mark's letter sound very much like a speech one would give if one wanted to run for president.
Yes.
History has had many moments like today. If I had some echo and some crowd cheering, could you help me with that, Brian? As we have made our great leaps from tribes to cities to nations, We've always had to build social infrastructure like communities, media, and governments for us to thrive and reach the next level. At each step, we learned how to come together to solve our challenges and accomplish greater things than we could alone. We've done it before. We'll do it again. Uh-oh, now you're really in trouble. He's going to quote Lincoln. I am reminded of President Lincoln's remarks during the American Civil War. We can succeed only by concert. This is the worst quote he could pick. It is not, can any of us imagine better, but can we all do better? The dogmas of the quiet, he might as well be in Latin. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty. Might be piled high, but I don't know if it's difficulty. And we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so must we think anew and act anew. It is an honor to be on this journey with you. Thank you for being part of this community. Thanks for everything you do to make the world more open and connected. You know, he left off. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America. That's very important. Thank you.
Well, he could really have used Lin-Manuel Miranda to
a little rap.
To put some music around some of that in a little. You know,
it's still early. Ed.
It really does sound like a stump speech. It really does.
It really does sound like a stump speech. On the other hand, there were.
It sounds like a nerdy stump speech.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but you know what? He said all the right words in those five statements. They might have been cliched, but they were the things that I wanted to hear.
Well, that's why I vote for him. Yeah,
and they were the things that I haven't necessarily heard from the other tech CEOs who made the pilgrimage to New York. And didn't come back saying, we agree, we disagree, we have a different vision, we have the same vision. They all just sort of went there, sat there uncomfortably, and then came out and kept their mouth shut. And so at least he's talking. He's talking, and it's in platitudes, but they're good platitudes.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't blame the tech CEO. I don't blame anybody because it's all baffling. And I think that if you're a CEO of especially of a publicly held company, it's very hard to understand what your duty is.
Exactly.
And I think this is really a terra nova for everybody. We're just all going. I mean,
unless you're IBM, don't go ahead and repeat.
Well, Ginni Rometty's another matter entirely. Yeah, I think he's running. I mean, after reading, the end of this, and I would vote for him only because he's this is like a Harvard student report. He's showing off a little bit. He's using big words. He's it's not deep. I don't think it's deeply thought. Sorry, Mark. But it doesn't feel like
any thought right now would be an improvement. Okay, so
yeah, I don't know. I think we could do worse.
He is not old enough to be president.
No. Okay. Oh, yeah. Get ready. He will
Eight
be.
Years. 12
He'll be
years.
35 yeah. on August 2019. He turns or 2020 turns 35.
Right.
So
right.
He will be able to file.
Yeah.
Right at the.
But
deadline.
I think he's clearly playing a long. Long game.
It might not
here.
Be 2020. It might be 2024. He's young enough that he could do that.
Or 2034.
Yeah, he's got 40 good years in him.
2036.
Yeah. Got some time.
He's 40 years younger than President Trump. So,
there's that. And I also kind of think imagine if Bill Gates decided to run. A little while ago.
What did you think of Bill Gates' statement that robots should be taxed? Let's take a break, and then I want to ask you about that. I thought that was really, it's definitely out of the box.
It's interesting. Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Well, everybody's trying these out. We're talking about universal basic income. We're really kind of trying to figure out what is this new world where jobs are disappearing to automation, artificial intelligence is spread like a peanut butter over everything. What does this new world look like, and how do you survive it? And I commend people like Bill Gates for at least trying stuff. I don't know what economists might think, but we'll take a break and we'll talk about that. Our show today, by the way, great panel. I gotta give you all praise every time we get together. It's so great to have Ed Bott, Christina Warren, Devendra Hardawar. If you're going to talk tech with some people, it's nice to get smart, tuned in, insightful people, and we got the best. Thank you for being here. Our show today brought to you by Squarespace. Speaking of the best place to make your next move, maybe your next website, Squarespace does it all. It's the best hosting, never goes down, plus the best software on top of it, the best content management system. It's never too late to reinvent yourself, change careers, maybe make a run for the White House. And if you're going to do it, make your next move known to the world with Squarespace.com. Because no matter what you're up to, Squarespace is going to, you're going to look pro. You're going to look like, because Squarespace has the best designers plus the best engineers. So your site is going to look great, but also work great and be very capable. Whether it's the perfect portfolio, a professional blog, an online store, yes, you can take campaign contributions through Squarespace. It makes it easy to create a beautiful website and look like an expert right from the start. Now, of course, if you are an expert, if you know HTML, CSS, JavaScript, the developer platform on Squarespace is second to none. You just check a box, become a developer, and you can use Git. You can do all, I mean, you could, it's amazing. But you don't have to be, and that's the point. You don't have to be an engineer to have a site that the best people in the world would say, that's, boy, you really know what you're doing. Tell your story. Reach millions of readers. And, you know, yeah, okay, it's nice, Squarespace, Medium, they give you, that looks nice. But wouldn't you prefer to put your posts, put that stuff, that content, start on your site, the site you own? Then put it, you can syndicate it. It's got RSS automatically. You can publish directly from the blog. You can put it right up on Medium or Twitter or Facebook. You can update your content once and then share it simultaneously across all your platforms. There are buttons, the share it buttons, the pin it buttons that make it easy for your visitors to kind of beat the drum for you, to share your stuff. You can also know your audience. They've got contact forms, sign-up forms, applications, surveys. You can they integrate with things like MailChimp, so if you want to do email campaigns and newsletters, you can do it right from your Squarespace site. They've got calendars. I put a calendar up there just so people know when I'm, you know, going to be on vacation, or we're going to have special shows. You can let visitors RSVP from the website. And by the way, every Squarespace site has e-commerce built in. It's the only platform that lets you create, manage, and brand your store. Not as an add-on, not as something hanging off the side. Your customers aren't going to go, oh, what happened? I'm in the cart now. This is ugly. It's the same template. It looks great. It looks exactly as you want it to. Plus, you get Squarespace Analytics, so you know exactly where your page views, your conversions, your popular content is. And when you do a store, you can take major credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay right off the bat, out of the bat. You don't have to have a merchant account. They do it all for you. Pursue your passion. Make your next move with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com. They've got a free trial there, but if you decide to buy, use the offer code TWIT, if you would. That way you'll get 10% off, and we'll get a nice pat on the head from Anthony and the Squarespace team. Squarespace.com. Offer code TWIT. We have to do that because Squarespace is advertising. They were on the Super Bowl. So we have to let them know, no, these guys came from TWIT, and it helps us. So if you do that, that'd be really, really great. So I don't know if Bill Gates, I don't know if he's just kind of blue skying or if this is like serious, but it kind of made sense to me. Maybe yep. That's because I'm not an economist. But he says if robots are going to take our jobs, mm-hmm. they ought to be taxed.
Yeah.
And pay Social yeah. Security.
Yeah.
It's very provocative. It's a great point. I mean, potential point. Like it's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to make up for
security,
the taxes.
At least other taxes.
Right.
Exactly. And you'd have to make up for the taxes that the workers would have paid. But also, mm-hmm. like, what is going to happen with all of these people? Like, that's the bigger thing. Like, are we going to have to, companies may need to help pay for the training for new types of jobs or something. My pie in the sky thing is like eventually a universal basic income, which will probably never happen. But this is kind of how you get that started.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, because so many people are moving to automation, even when it doesn't always make sense. Sometimes it totally makes sense to move to automation. In some cases, it can actually, you know, cost more and not save a huge amount of time because they want to cut down on workforce spending and taxes and other things. And mm-hmm. that's all well and good. But if you're going to be doing that, I mean, I do think that's a very interesting idea to say, okay, well, you've got to at least pay for some of the corporate taxes or some of the other taxes that you would be missing out on because of this.
Well, the economic concept involved here is called externalities. And it's something that we as a nation, you know, I talked about how the internet was developed without people thinking about the long-term consequences of how it was being built, about how it would be. Well, those are externalities that, you know, cars were built without thinking about, oh, all the carbon they're going to be putting into the environment, or all the, you know, or the roads that are going to have to be built there. So they were given the car makers were basically given free subsidies early on because they weren't paying for the externalities, the pollution that their devices were emitting that were causing impact on third parties everywhere in the world. So it's nice to have someone thinking early on in the process about building a way to compensate third parties for externalities, you know, into the thing. You know, Bill Gates has turned out to be, he's a pretty smart guy. I'll tell you what, I knew him, you know, way back when, and the transformation that he has made from, you know, ruthless capitalist to the guy who, you know, is obsessed. He is as obsessed with saving the lives of children now as he was with, you know, selling PCs back in, you know, 1983. It's amazing.
Speaking of saving lives, the Bill and Melinda Gates annual letter this year for their foundation was great. They start with a letter from Warren Buffett to them last December, saying, you know, because Buffett made a historically huge, I think the largest donation ever in history to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And he said, now, of course, a nonprofit, a foundation isn't the same as a business. And so an annual report on your profit and so forth isn't the same thing. But it would be nice for me and others to know what you did with my money. In other words, a scorecard. And I loved it because Bill and Melinda took him at his word and said, okay. They said, 10 years ago when we got first word of your gift to the foundation, we were speechless. It was the biggest single gift anyone ever gave anybody for anything. And we know we owe you a fantastic return on your investment. And this is the return that they said. The number of children's lives saved, 122 million since 1990.
No big deal.
No big deal.
You know, and they explain where this number comes from. The number of childhood deaths since 1990, kids under five, has been cut in half. And it's in great part because of inoculations that the Gates Foundation has provided worldwide, reducing childhood mortality, education, nutrition. They say the best deal is vaccinations. Global vaccination coverage is at its highest that it's ever been. And a lot of this comes from that money that Warren Buffett and Bill and others gave to the foundation. It's a great letter. So you're right. I think he is a really interesting. It's not like Andrew Carnegie, who felt so guilty about the steel business and busting unions that he built libraries all over the place to assuage his guilty conscience. I think Bill really, I don't think he has anything to apologize for the success of Microsoft. It changed the world. And I love it that he says, I'm going to give it all away. And I think Warren Buffett wants to do the same.
And relating it to Zuckerberg too, like it's nice that
and Mark's
he's always
that,
looked
right?
at, yeah. Like Mark is looking at him as a role model, and that is probably the best news we could see. Like, look at their foundation that, you know, Zuckerberg and his wife are starting to. Yeah. So I think with that sort of role model in place, it would be, fascinating to see what Zuckerberg could do if he were to run as president eventually.
I didn't ask you, but when we were talking about cell phones, maybe I should bring this up now. Verizon this week said, we'll do unlimited too. And now all four carriers in the U.S., all four big carriers, offer unlimited data. And I remember when AT&T, was it Ralph, I think, said the worst mistake he ever made when AT&T started selling the iPhone was offering unlimited data. It's his biggest regret.
Right.
But they're back. They're doing it again.
Well, it's unlimited. There's a huge asterisk.
Wait a minute. You missed, folks who are listening only, you missed the air quotes.
There's air quotes. Sorry, there's air quotes around unlimited. It's unlimited because caveats are very much a part of this.
Yeah, because there's no unlimited. It is unlimited, but after 22 gigabytes, at least with Verizon, it'll slow down a lot.
Yeah, it's 22 gigabytes with Verizon, 28 with T-Mobile, yeah. 23 with Sprint, yeah. And they don't guarantee you that they'll slow it down, but they say that they can. Then there is the limit of tethering. So if you want to use it for hotspot, you're limited to 10 gigabytes of LTE.
They used to charge for that. That's part of the deal now. So
yeah,
that's good.
Yeah, well, T-Mobile used to charge for that.
Verizon? Oh, no, they couldn't, right? They had a consent decree.
Exactly. It was all part of the same thing. And I think AT&T... I'm not sure how it works. I know the AT&T Unlimited plan does not include tethering at all. But Verizon T-Mobile and Sprint used to charge extra if you wanted to use your quote unquote unlimited accounts with tethering. Now you don't have to. But if you use more than 10 gigabytes, then you get shut down to 3G speeds on Verizon and T-Mobile and 2G speeds on Sprint. But I mean, look, hell has frozen over, right? Like I don't know about you guys. I never thought like in 2017, we'd be even remotely talking about with an asterisk or not anything with the word unlimited and Verizon in the same sentence.
Is it fair to give T-Mobile and John Ledger credit for this?
For sure.
Yes. Yes. I would say that he definitely forced everybody else's hands. In my opinion, I think that and T-Mobile subscribers have, you know, gone through the roof. Like they are still very much in third place, but like they passed Sprint sometime last year, and that was a big deal. And they continue to add new subscribers every single quarter. And I think a lot of it is because John Legere has been so aggressive and T-Mobile has been so aggressive with their pricing that it kind of forced everybody else's hands. And then what happened was when Verizon followed suit, which was not expected, at least I was surprised, T-Mobile had to immediately follow up and take some of the worst caveats in their plans and make it part of their official thing. Sprint had to make changes. And then finally, you know, AT&T, who, you know, had been a really big holdout, almost as big of a holdout as Verizon, came back and said, okay, we'll do an unlimited plan as well. So,
you know who I want to give credit to?
Who's that?
U.S. antitrust regulators who prevented a T-Mobile Sprint merger, who prevented an AT&T T-Mobile merger, who kept four companies in play because really it's because of competition.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. And then, of course, that, you know, now it looks like...
And now it's
like,
out the window.
Now it's potentially out the window. And SoftBank, it's very interesting. You know, before the rumor was that, you know, Sprint wanted to, or the story was, you know, Sprint wanted to buy T-Mobile and then Sprint would basically run the two companies. And now there was a Reuters report that basically indicates that SoftBank is willing to sell itself to Deutsche Telekom and basically say, okay, how much will you give us for Sprint? We'll see if that would be allowed to happen or not. I mean, obviously AT&T was not allowed to buy T-Mobile. Sprint was not allowed to buy T-Mobile. Mm-hmm. But we'll see with the different administration if T-Mobile and Sprint could actually merge.
Yeah, and Christina, you mentioned that you were surprised to see this news too. I'm not that sure about it because I feel like we had to get back to unlimited data. All these companies have been selling us networks that are supposedly super fast, crazy fast.
Right.
In some respects, like LTE is faster than most people's home broadband.
Definitely.
And we all are basically driving around with a super powered, it's like we're driving, you know, really, really fast cars and we could just drive them up around the block a couple of times. Like we've been incredibly limited with these networks. And
it's like owning a Ferrari on the 405.
Exactly.
You're not going anywhere.
Exactly.
What is it? The East Side Expressway or whatever. Yeah. Long Island.
Of course, you guys know what's going to happen, though, right?
What?
Mm-hmm. We all get unlimited data right as they're about to start the introduction of 5G. And once 5G comes out, I guarantee you that these unlimited plans will not work with 5G. They're going to start the charging thing all over again. I mean, because that's what happened with 3G, right? Like you had the unlimited plan.
3G. But if you want LTE...
And then for LTE, you'd have to pay more. And then eventually those companies, people who were on those grandfathered in plans, were forced to get the 4G support. But it took a while. And it took like lawyers getting involved and saying, no, you can't actually...
Elon's going to fix this. Elon is going to fix this. We're going to have gigabit internet from satellites, 4,000 satellites rotating around the Earth in a low Earth orbit.
Yeah. And how much is that going to cost, Leo?
Oh, don't think about it as money. They did file an application. SpaceX filed an application on Tuesday for with the FCC for as many as 1,000 satellites to be launched as soon as 2019. The idea is these are very low Earth orbit. That means the low latency, right? And that's been a problem with satellite internet. It's really the big problem. That's why Project Loon is thinking about stratospheric balloons, while Mark Zuckerberg is thinking about killer drones. I'm sorry, it's not killer. It's Akilla drones. Because the lower, the better, the less latency. And in fact, the SpaceX says that they think latencies will be 25 to 35 milliseconds, which is better than many terrestrial internet service providers. That's you think cool. This is pie in the sky?
Literally.
Coffee cans in the sky. Well, anyway.
Well, it's a little much. I mean, yeah. Historically, the way to bet on any technological development on this is to bet against the people who are saying it's going to happen really soon, and to put all your chips on about 4 years after that, because mm-hmm. everyone overestimates the short term disruption and then they're disappointed by it, but then in the long term everything turns out to happen and be much more impressive than anyone said in the first place. So yeah, this isn't pie in the sky. It's all going to happen. It's just not going to be on any of the timelines that people are talking about right now.
I mean, we'll see too, like what they're proposing with 5G and everything is that it could get us much, much faster speeds across longer distances and things like that. Yes. So yeah, I don't even know what the point, like if 5G is as good as what they've been building up for so long, this may be kind of redundant at a point. And to what you were saying too, Christina, like LTE isn't going anywhere, right? It may get right. a little faster once 5G networks start getting implemented, but even if you're limited to unlimited if you're stuck with unlimited LTE speeds,
I like limited great. To that's unlimited fantastic. I think that's a good phrase.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you, Devendra. I mean, the reality is, I mean, I actually 22 gigabytes is pretty good, but at this point, mm-hmm. I do hope they will, as networks get bigger, start to increase those limits because more and more people can start to use
right.
their phones as their primary ISP because, frankly, it's yeah. faster and in many parts of the country,
right.
Better than what you might get, through cable.
And, mm-hmm. I'm getting dinged by Comcast because I went over a terabyte in a month, and I imagine if I would hit that number with a cell phone too, if that were soon. Well, I think we should wrap this up. We want to send out thoughts and prayers to people in Sweden after that horrific attack the other night I read about on the internet. Thank you. I shouldn't say that. Thank you.
You should make it clear that nothing actually happened.
Nothing actually happened, okay?
The Swedish chef
just
massacre.
Just in case you are listening after the fact.
I saw it on Fox News. Nothing happened.
I'm googling how to say douchebag in Swedish.
No, just wait. The tweet will happen, and you won't need to look it up. Thank you so much, Ed Bott, ZDNet. Plug something. Hashtag pray for Sweden, by the way. Hashtag pray for Sweden.
Windows 10 Inside Out 2nd Edition out there, and we're working on an update to it. So we're going to start doing – we'll do 3 updates, electronic updates, over the next year. So we're trying to keep the traditional printed book and ebook relevant in this fast-paced world. So Windows 10 Inside Out 2nd Edition. It's a good book.
By the way, if you want to – Facebook does have a Swedish flag overlay that you could put on your Facebook icon to show your support for the troubled people of Sweden. I think I'm going to do that right now. Christina – Christine, I think this is a good meme. I want to start this right now. Christina Warren from the fabulous Gizmodo. Anything else you want to plug?
Yeah, I already plugged it before, but if you like listening to hear me talk, my podcast Rocket on Relay FM talk about tech once a week. So that's a good time. And read my articles
with the wonderful Brianna Wu and who? I'm sorry, who's the third one? I forgot.
Simone de Rochefort. Right, she's great.
Yeah. Thank you, Christina. Really great having you.
Thank you, Leo.
Devendra Hardawar, always a pleasure. thank you for joining us. Anything you want to plug, my friend?
So many things. Check out Engadget. We have restarted our podcast, so that's been a lot of fun trying to figure out a way to kind of speak to the audience a little differently. And I still podcast about movies and TV at slashfilm.com. And nice. That's been going great.
Nice. And we do Twit here every week if you want to come back. We love having you. 3 p.m. Pacific. That would be 6 p.m. Eastern time on a Sunday afternoon or evening, 2300 UTC. Please join us. If you want, you can watch live. Join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. You can also watch on YouTube Live now, youtube.com/twit, Ustream, Twitch, many ways to watch. If you can't watch live, on-demand audio and video is always available after the fact on our website, twit.tv, or wherever you get your favorite podcast, Stitcher, Slacker, Google, everything, everywhere, iTunes. If you'd like to be in studio with us, hey, we'd love that. We get a great studio audience here today. Just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you. We got another week or so for the Twit survey. If you get a moment, it takes just 2 minutes. Go to twit.tv/survey. It helps us better understand you. We're not collecting personal information at all. We just want to have know in aggregate a little bit more about our audience. It also helps us with advertising. They always want to know, well, is there anybody listening? You let us know. twit.tv/survey. I thank you all for being here. I think we did a good job. We could pat ourselves on the back and go home. Another Twit is in the can. Good night, everybody. And I did actually, in support for Sweden, I put the Swedish flag on my on my face.
Oh, man. Yeah,
I think that's very important. We all do that.
Doing the Twit.